Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
So who wants to join me in the Harambe salute? Here we go. Harambe! 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 Harambe!
Our main event conversation, Gorillas' Lives Matter, Harambe and the public shaming of a black family. A little black boy and his mother go to Cincinnati Zoo on a Saturday. The four-year-old wants to take a closer look at the gorilla enclave. He wants to go in, and he's just 4 years old. His mama tells him no. The next thing, the little one has dropped 15 feet into the moat of the gorilla enclave where Harambe, a 400-pound rare wild silverback gorilla, is kept. The little boy is in the enclave for 10 whole minutes. He's being dragged around first in the moat and then the enclave, his head banging on concrete. He sustains serious injuries and is rushed to hospital. Cincinnati Zoo took the decision to put the gorilla down to kill him and save the little boy's life. All of that happened on a Saturday in May. The zoo director's decision sparked anger, condemnation, criticism, and an actual campaign. The story went global. The anger, condemnation, and critique had two directions. First, the zoo for putting down the silverback gorilla, a rare species. A Facebook campaign called Justice for Harambe was started and has collected more than 1,000 signatures. The Cincinnati Zoo director held a press conference to explain and defend his decision as protests were held and the campaign grew.
The child was being dragged around. His head was banging on concrete. This was not a gentle thing. The child was at risk. We're very fortunate that he's okay. So when it was determined that the child was being injured, not potentially injured, but was being injured, both down in the moat and then up on the ground, that we had to make a decision to shoot him, and we did.
The Cincinnati Zoo director explained this was unprecedented action and an emotional time for the zoo workers.
A very emotional time at the Cincinnati Zoo. It's unprecedented. We have never had to kill a dangerous animal in the middle of an emergency situation. The zoo's been here 143 years, so that's saying a lot. There were hugs. The people that knew Harambe the best, his keepers, shared a lot of stories about him. But everybody at the zoo feels the loss. There's no doubt about it.
The second focus for the anger was directed squarely at the black family, the black mother and the black father. The mother was lectured, hectored, shamed, condemned, accused. There was even speculation that the mother should be charged with neglect. And then the black father was targeted. Journalist Laura Collins wrote a piece via Cincinnati for the online newspaper The Daily Mail, in which she detailed the little boy's father's entire criminal history. That story has now been shared 26,000 times on Facebook. The world learned their names, Daddy, Dion Dickerson, Mother, Michelle Clegg. From social media to some mainstream media, the tone of the coverage was accusatory, all empathy reserved for a primate animal. Few stories on the shock, hurt, and horror of a mother watching her baby, breath held, totally vulnerable, as a 400-pound gorilla drags him around first the moat and then the enclave, his head hitting and bouncing off concrete like a rag doll. Journalist Sean King reported in the New York Daily News there have been a series of horrifying incidents at zoos involving children and families. Neither they nor their parents were named, criminalized, or shamed in the way that we've seen with this black family. King gives multiple examples. 2015, a child fell into a cheetah exhibit at Cleveland Zoo, neither child nor parents named. Again, 2015, a child scales a fence at Kansas Zoo and is mauled by a leopard. No details of a parent's criminal history are revealed. In 2014, two jaguars mauled a toddler who fell into the jaguar exhibit of the Little Rock Zoo. The child's identity, the identity of his parents and their criminal history, never mentioned. 15 years ago, a child fell into another gorilla exhibit and was rescued. The criminal history of the parents, never mentioned. At the Pittsburgh Zoo, a child lunged from his mother's arms into the African spotted dog exhibit and was mauled to death. The zoo actually settled a wrongful death suit with that family. A tiger at the San Francisco Zoo mauled a 17-year-old boy to death. A drunk family member was witnessed taunting the tiger beforehand. The zoo settled with that family again. Not a single story was written on the criminal history of anybody in that young man's family. As Sean King asks, quote, "Why in the world is the criminal history of this young boy's father in Cincinnati being spread all over the world?" Unquote. There are other questions. Why is a black mother being lectured, shamed, accused of being a bad parent? Why is there speculation that charges should be brought for neglect? Why has Harambe, a 400-pound primate, been humanized and a black family, a mother and father, demonized? Let's talk Gorillas Lives Matter, Harambe and the shaming of a black family. Usha Bendele, let me start with you.
It's interesting that we're having this discussion when at the same time in the United States, we are watching a revisioning of Roots. And in the episode that aired last night, the last thing we saw was really the child of Kunta Kinte and Bell being snatched away and taken by other slave owners to a whole other plantation states away. And, you know, I raise that to say that we should be reminded that there's never been a time in the history of the United States that we were considered people who had a right to our children, that we knew what to do with our children. In many ways, we've always been criminalized. And always there's always been this air of we didn't have the ability to care for them. And so, you know, I think that we live within that circumstance, but I think that it's also important to say that we're having this discussion about a zoo in the very same state where Tamir Rice was shot. Tamir Rice, 12 years old, shot in 1 to 2 seconds by a police officer, and we could say that the gorilla got 10 full minutes more than Tamir Rice's life got consideration. And so for all of these people who are, you know, having fits and starts about the death of a gorilla, which I would like to have not have seen, but I think you have to make the choice between the life of the gorilla and the life of a child, and you also have to look at what were the safety precautions that a child could even get in there and worm their way into a gorilla's enclosure. That's on the zoo, right? Is that, you know, that here this gorilla got 10 minutes for people to do something. Tamir Rice got 1 to 2 seconds. Where are all those folks who didn't say anything about Tamir Rice, who sided with the police, who gave that 12-year-old boy 1 to 2 seconds of life to live, you know, before he shot him to death?
Dr. Christina Greer.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, when I heard the story and I heard the location, because obviously geography always matters, that's immediately my first thought was Tamir Rice. This is the same city where we have seen a complete and blatant disregard for black life. And so I find that so many people who are outraged about what happened to a gorilla, which, yes, on the one hand, you know, I'm sure we all love animals and love God's creatures. No, it's senseless that we have animals caged up in these small areas and he lost his life. But it's a child. I think it's really fascinating, though, because someone wrote on Twitter, you know, we know nothing about Dylan Roof's parents.
Wow! Hey, yo, drama, hold up, sir. Hold on. Stop the motherfucking record.
All right.
I want you to Pondy replay, drama. Pondy replay. Give him one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
Someone wrote on Twitter, you know, we know nothing about Dylan Roof's parents. And this young child, it's an unfortunate incident. It is on the zoo for their lack of safety precautions. But immediately, it's the shaming of black parents. It's, you know, this constant finger wagging and this paternalistic attitude in this country that black people don't know how to govern themselves, and they surely don't know how to govern their own children. And we know nothing about all of the families of all these other tragedies that have happened at zoos where children have been mauled by animals and either lost their lives or not. And so I think it is so disingenuous for these thousands and thousands of people to care so much more about the life of a gorilla, and they have said nothing about the countless numbers of children who have been murdered by the state.
I've seen what's around the corner. I've seen what's over the horizon. And I promise you, you niggas have nothing to celebrate. And no, I won't get there with you. I'm going to Canada.
In order for judges to have a better understanding of the folks that come before them to be sentenced, it's often important to get as much information as possible to look into their background and circumstances, which often affect their behaviors and the choices that they make.
Well, that is Pamela Williams, the chief judge of the Nova Scotia Provincial and Family Courts, addressing the broad issue of cultural assessment when determining a sentence for someone who's been convicted. Right now, a different Halifax judge is considering if the history of discrimination against African Canadians in Nova Scotia should be a mitigating factor in the sentencing of a black man convicted of murder. Last February, 27-year-old Kale Leonard Gabriel was convicted of second-degree murder for the 2010 shooting of Ryan White. And last week, a Nova Scotia Supreme Court judge delayed Mr. Gabriel's sentencing to allow the defense time to prepare a cultural assessment, a report which looks at a defendant's racial and cultural heritage. Chief Judge Pamela Williams is on the record supporting these reports.
A sentence must be proportionate to the gravity of the offense and also the degree of responsibility of the offender. So if we have a cultural assessment, or we have a GLADU report, or we have a mental health assessment, it gives us much more information, much richer information on the individual. We may be able to help identify what are the root causes of the crime. And if a sentence can address the causes and not just the effects of crime, then perhaps we're able to reduce the likelihood of the individual coming into conflict with the law again.
Well, the number of black Canadians in federal prisons has jumped by 80% in the last 10 years. Advocates say that spike is one of the reasons Canadian courts should make wider use of cultural assessments. Robert Wright is a social worker based in Halifax, and that's where we've reached him today. Hello.
Good morning.
Why are cultural assessments an important part of pre-sentencing for black Canadians?
Well, pre-sentence reports are considered and often prepared for any person who's before the court who's been convicted of a serious offense, and a person's cultural, racial background and how that may have affected them and even affected their involvement in crime is an important part of the background information that a judge would want to have.
And you've written cultural assessments in the past. What's involved in preparing such a thing?
Mm-hmm. Well, like any other kind of pre-sentence report or psychological or psychiatric assessment, these assessments start with interviews of the individual and then contact with collaterals. So a person may want to interview the individual and interview their family members. If the individual has been involved in any kind of civic activities, the Boy Scout leader, a basketball coach, former teachers, members of the person's community who would understand the nature of the community and the nature of the conditions that the young person grew or the person grew up in. So it's a pretty standard assessment.
Well, it's pretty standard, except that this is different. We know that there was a decision called GLADU that actually talked about doing these assessments for Indigenous people. Am I correct?
That is correct.
And they are not routinely done for people based on their race if they're black. Am I correct?
That is correct, although that I believe that trend is changing. And you heard Judge Williams, the chief of our provincial court, explaining why.
Okay. So I know that there are always pre-sentencing reports, but what distinguishes this kind of report, a cultural assessment?
Well, I'd say this, that the cultural assessment focuses on the person's race and cultural background. And I don't think it's particularly a special assessment. In fact, what I think is happening is that we are recognizing that the pre-sentence reports, psychological and psychiatric reports that are routinely brought before the court are actually incomplete because they miss large sections of the person's life experience that is tied up in culture and race. So it's not just a person's culture, but the fact that an individual who's Aboriginal or African-Canadian lives a life within a the political and racial and historical challenges of their community. So to live your life as an Aboriginal person or a black person means that you must encounter racism as part of your life experience. And other reports tend to ignore those factors.
And in this particular case, how might a cultural assessment of a man convicted of second-degree murder have an effect?
Well, again, one of the things that Judge Williams talked about is that these assessments help to give judges who are sentencing a more nuanced or in-depth knowledge of the person so that the sentence can be made in a way that is designed not only for deterrence but to promote the rehabilitation of the individual. So, for example, a person might be sentenced to a particular institution, or a person may be sentenced with the their length of sentence may be adjusted because the cultural assessment helps to show that their level of criminality and level of dangerousness is different than perhaps might have been understood previously.
There are critics of the GLAD you report that argue that it's a get-out-of-jail card. How do you respond to that?
Well, anyone who says that a GLADU report is a get-out-of-jail card for Aboriginal persons doesn't understand the statistics on incarceration of Indigenous persons. Indigenous persons are grossly overrepresented among persons in correctional facilities. In some jurisdictions where they might make up 8 or 9% of the population, they represent 40% of the incarcerated population. So a GLADU report certainly isn't a get-out-of-jail-free card. What a GLADU report is, metaphorically, I guess, is a recognition of the need for the whole criminal justice system to address the systemic racism that is at work in the criminal justice system. Mm.
Robert Wright, social worker, he wrote a cultural assessment for a black Nova Scotia youth who had been convicted of attempted murder. He's in our Halifax studio. Now, the backdrop to cases such as the Kale Leonard Gabriel case and his victim, Ryan White, is one that has become frustratingly familiar and potentially avoidable, according to my next guest. Anthony Morgan is a lawyer for the firm Falconers LLP. In February, he authored a report to the United Nations called The Blackening Margins of Multiculturalism, the African-Canadian Experience of Exclusion from the Economic, Social, and Cultural Promise and Prosperity of Canada. Anthony Morgan is with me in our Toronto studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Anna Maria.
What are you thinking as you listen to what Mr. Wright was just saying?
Well, I think it's about time that we get to a point within our justice system where we recognize that we have to appreciate the full context and background of an individual so judges can shape fair and just sentences.
And so how useful would a cultural assessment be in the case of Kale Leonard Gabriel?
Well, I think it's important that we understand what are the economic factors? What are the social factors? We know that this crime took place, for instance, in Mulgrave Park. Mulgrave Park within Halifax has its own history of social exclusion. It's a public housing project where communities were moved, some of from the historic community of Africville, and placed within this community. And there's not the kind of access to jobs, education opportunities, transportation, and so on and so forth that would allow for the healthy development of community. And so it's important that any judge who's going to be sentencing him be able to factor those social conditions in.
Ryan White's family is going to be looking for a sentence that, quote, fits the crime that took their son's life. What concerns do you have about what lies ahead for Kale Leonard Gabriel as he faces sentencing and potential prison time?
Well, my concern has to do with, of course, looking at the overrepresentation of black men in prison. I don't think he should get certainly as Mr. Wright noted, a get out of jail free card. And he certainly won't. He is convicted. Yes, he is.
And he's convicted of a very serious crime.
Exactly. And so I don't want anybody to think that that's what we're looking for when it comes to a cultural assessment. But in terms of determining his eligibility for parole, we have to be able to look at the factors that may have led him to engage in this behavior and be able to determine his sentence accordingly. And so the concern is that we may get a situation where that is not adequately addressed, but it looks like there's an opening here to influence the judge so that, again, a fair and appropriate sentence for this particular individual is taken into consideration.
What kinds of things could that look like? I know you can't, you know, we can't really second guess what a judge is thinking on this, but what are the options? If you wanted to look at a cultural assessment and say, okay, there's this person who's been convicted has also been a victim of systemic racism. Ergo, when we sentence him, we will do what? What would they do that would be different?
So I won't speak to this specific case because it's not a case that I've worked on, but I'll speak to cultural assessments in general and the impact that they can have. And so, for instance, we might look at saying maybe instead of having such a long custodial sentence, we'll have a sentence where the person is in community and servicing community because we found historically that they, for instance, have issues of abandonment where maybe they were put up for adoption. They ended up in the child welfare system. They have difficulty maintaining connections and therefore they feel alienated from community. And so the judge factors that in and says, well, maybe we can place him with a community organization so we can build those healthy relationships, get connected to community, and that be actually a part of their sentence. And I'm saying he because the overrepresentation of black people within prison is overwhelmingly a black male phenomenon. Certainly we're seeing it with black females for sure. But I'm saying he again just because it specifically impacts or has a very disproportionate impact on men.
Well, I want to pick up on the actual numbers. I have a clip here. This is Akwasi Owusu-Bempah, an assistant professor at the University of Toronto at Mississauga's Faculty of Sociology, who spent time analyzing data on prisons in Canada. Listen to this.
We know that both at the federal and provincial levels that blacks generally and black males are greatly overrepresented. When we look at the provincial for Nova Scotia, for example, blacks are overrepresented by about 7 times their proportion of the population. So whereas black Nova Scotians make up about 2.1% of their population, they made up 14% of the prison population in 2010-2011. At the federal level, blacks are overrepresented about 3 times their proportion of the population. There's been a fairly substantial growth in the black federal offender population, upwards of about 80% over the past 10 years.
Okay, big numbers there. Anthony Morgan, how do you explain that overrepresentation? What's going on?
Well, one of the important things that we should be considering in this conversation is the decisions that we make around policing. So we're having this conversation in Ontario about carding and street checks. And we have to be able to consider the fact that disproportionate targeting of certain populations will, of course, lead to overrepresentation in prison. If you look at the history of carding, when the practice was implemented and then accelerated, you see a consistent line between that and the times at which the increase of black people within prisons has happened. Now, within the data on carding, we know that it specifically targets young black men. Now, the federal prison population, more than half of the people in federal prison, black people in prison, are under the age of 30. More than half. Right, so we know that this is there is some sort of connection here that it's. I don't think it's just a correlation. When you have policing that is going around and targeting specific individuals in specific communities, overwhelmingly black, indigenous, brown, then you get the expression of that within the overrepresentation within our prison systems. And so when we have cultural assessments, this is something that would be considered where a judge would look and say, okay, what is criminal justice policy? What is this practice that surrounds policing within this particular community? For instance, Mulgrave Park. But let's look at other communities in other cities. And folks will say Jane and Finch in Regent Park, in Jamestown, and so on and so forth, and say, okay, yes, this is odious behavior. This is a problem. It needs to be punished. But we also have to recognize that there's a force like the Toronto Anti-Violence Intervention Strategy, TAVIS, which targets people within this community. So how do we balance that to determine a just sentence?
In 1982, President Reagan declared illegal drugs a threat to national security.
We intend to do what is necessary to end the drug menace and cripple organized crime. We live at a turning point, one of those critical eras in history when time and circumstances unite with the sound instincts of good and decent people to make a crucial difference in the lives of future generations.
Since then, the U.S. has spent billions of dollars trying to combat the spread of illegal substances as part of the war on drugs. In his latest book, Art Benavie says the war on drugs has come at too high a cost. He says law enforcement agencies profit from questionable search and seizure methods and often violate civil liberties. The book is called How the Drug War Ruins American Lives. Art Benavie is an emeritus professor of economics at UNC Chapel Hill and joins me now in the studio. Welcome back, Art. Good to have you here.
Good to see you. Reagan also talked about the bloody battle like Verdun in the First World War in that speech.
Yeah, no, there was a lot. And a lot of equating also thugs and some of the coded racial language, which I think is also part of this. So tell us about the war on drugs and a little bit more about the background and context. For this this epidemic of...
I think it was building up anger and confusion and fear. Because of what happened in the 60s and 70s, the culture wars and the violence and the riots and that sort of thing. And I think so. And it was a bipartisan. Reagan was riding a crest here. It was not something that he just did. The Democrats were every bit as supportive as the Republicans for this. And basically what they did is they got control over local drug crime, which is nonviolent crime, by making sure that the police profited from the drug war. And they did it in two ways. One was quite amazing. Both of these ways of giving the police profits exist even now. And one of them in 1984 was a forfeiture law, which basically allowed the government to seize, confiscate property permanently from people on the basis of very slim evidence. And without bringing criminal charges against the person. That exists today. I think that is a crucial point. And basically what you're doing with that is you're preferring charges against an inanimate object like your house, like your car, like your cash, like your bonds and so forth. That's one way that they raise. Well, the other way came out in 1988, and that's grants that basically reward law enforcement for arresting people for drug violations, focused totally on drugs. Again, nonviolent crime we're talking about. So as a result of these two fundraising things for police, there was a skyrocket in the drug war starting in the late 1980s and only plateaued in recent years. And this is the theme of my book, because this skyrocketing of the drug war, this escalation of the drug war, okay, is a major factor, for example, that caused mass incarceration and mass arrests of nonviolent people. And also it generated a whole bunch of erosions in our property rights and our human rights. That's the whole focus of the book.
Well, let's talk more about that. But before we get to that, you've said nonviolent crime several times. But the fact is there's a lot of violence associated with drug dealing. There's
absolutely
the violence of maintaining your turf.
That's right.
There's the destruction of human lives, people who become addicted.
Exactly,
and if it's an industry and I can profit from your addiction, I'll
do
it. That's destructive and a form of violence. A lot of people get hurt because of illegal.
a lot of people get killed. I think you're exactly right. And I think that the drug war itself generates a great deal of violence. I mean, you have these drug cartels, for example. They are fighting with one another, and people are caught in the crossfire. So there's definitely there's many reasons, for example, why the drug war itself is causing a lot of violence. That's true, and a lot of that's connected with the drugs. Basically, my book deals with the nonviolent arrests and incarcerations for drugs.
Well, tell us more about forfeiture, because, again, this places an incentive and rewards police agencies for focusing on drug crimes, which means attention is shifted from other crimes as well. So you can't just –
That's exactly right. There's a lot of research that shows that the police focusing on drug crimes do not focus on other crimes, including violent crimes. So that's strongly supported by research. And basically, the way the forfeiture thing works is this. You have law enforcement, for example, who on the basis of probable cause can come from a snitch, it can come from hearsay, it can come from all sorts of things. It's easy to get probable cause for police. If they have probable cause that your property has violated the drug law, your inanimate property, your house is violated, like the drugs in your house or drugs in your car, then what they can do is seize, that is, take possession of that item, okay? They then can turn it over to the state, although not in North Carolina. That's exceptional. They will turn it over to the federal government, okay? At that point, a judge will usually, invariably, it'll be a judge that will decide on the basis of very slim evidence. The evidence is more likely than not that property broke the law. If that's decided and people don't come in to defend their property, which less than 20% of people do, you're stacked up against the government experts, then the profits from that go to the state and they go to the federal government, up to 80% for the state, and the other 20% goes mostly to the Attorney General of the United States. So you can see that this introduces into our criminal justice system an element of corruption, because now it's in the interest of the police to seize your property. They get money for it. Okay.
Yeah. Well, not only does it create that kind of preference and reward system that's going to create these distortions in the system, but you talked about snitches too. The idea that this is another aspect of corruption that even judges have talked about.
Exactly.
Tell us more about how they play a role.
Well,
in this.
What the drug war is an interesting kind of crime, because you have two transactors, okay, and that both transactors are willing transactors, which means that the signal that a law has been broken, a drug law has been broken, doesn't get to the police. So they have to go undercover. When the police go undercover, they need snitches to help them navigate the underworld. So, and the snitches, of course, are in there. I mean, they're trying very hard to get their sentences reduced. And also, they get a lot of money. It's a huge industry. So then you have the snitches frequently lying. It's well known that snitches are notorious liars, and many people wind up in prison, sometimes even on death row, on the basis of false testimony from snitches. And the interesting thing is that the snitches are very often they're protected by the police, who find them invaluable, and they're protected in the way that, like in court, if you are confronting somebody who has accused you of something and it's a snitch that provided the evidence, they will try very hard not to let the snitch be made public. Otherwise, the police lose that snitch.
Right. You got to protect their credibility.
And the snitch also can wind up getting killed.
Right. So they need to play both ends of the law and be protected by the law enforcement as well as their credibility.
Exactly.
So all of this stuff is building in. We talked earlier about the fact that drugs are a bad thing. They do ruin lives and they do lead to some violence on the street. But the suggestion that it is that the war on drugs was really about public safety, I think, is pretty well exposed as not true. And this goes back to the Nixon administration. And you get a quote from John Ehrlichman.
I have an incredible quote here that I have to read to you, because I was very lucky to find it. It was on the radio. Okay, the radio did this.
Yep. So it had to be true. It had to be true.
Right. Well, it was after he came back from prison and had gotten religion. And then what he did is he let the cat out of the bag when it came to the drug war. And here's what he said. Look, we understood we couldn't make it illegal to be young or poor or black in the United States, but we could criminalize their common pleasures. We understood that drugs were not the health problem we were making them out to be, but it was such a perfect issue that we couldn't resist it.
Right. And all part of the Southern strategy that, that emerges out of the Goldwater debacle
exactly.
And becomes raised to a high art by the Reagan administration. You have Robert Novak in 1964 reporting out of a meeting of Republican leaders, this party has decided, in fact, if not in name, to become the party of white men.
That's right. That's right. In 1964, it happened exactly. And Lyndon Johnson said it was going to happen.
Right. Yeah. So we've got this trajectory. It's building and building. Now, what about the effect? Well, maybe this was part of a plan to split poor white men from black men and all of that. And we've seen how that strategy has played out, and certainly today in our political discourse. But, you know, my question is, did it have an effect? Look, if you're stopping the use of drugs, maybe it's not such a bad thing.
Well, this is the thing that I'm not sure whether I'm directly answering your question, but what had the effect on me was to look at the impact of this surge in the drug war that started in the 1980s. And it wasn't just mass incarceration. It was a vast increase in racial injustices resulting from actions by law enforcement, which the Supreme Court was very happy to be a cheerleader for.
Well, what do you mean? Give me some examples. What are you talking about?
Well, you're talking about the fact that the drug war is a perfect venue for racial injustice because you have something like 40 million people a year who are using drugs, but the police can only arrest less than 5%. So the question is, where do the police direct their forces in the drug war? Well, we know from overwhelming research that most of us have the view that that drug traffickers are people of color, and the police normally have that view too. So they focus on African Americans in their actions, and white sellers, white traffickers, research has shown, are invisible to the police. They so often don't even see them. Now, when the police do this, okay, they're focusing on blacks, so there's a huge disproportion in blacks. We know that blacks are being jailed and arrested at far greater rates than their actual use of the drugs. Certainly far more, the rate is far greater than it is for whites, okay? Well, do the police get punished for this? Does the Supreme Court say you can't do this, that you can't just go out there and arrest people like that, with practically no evidence at all? And the answer is no. The Supreme Court supports this wholly. You can have, the idea that you can steal a golf club as your third offense and wind up in jail for life, and this doesn't violate the Eighth Amendment, that's what the Supreme Court says. And one of the justices was saying, yeah, well, that might as well throw the Eighth Amendment out.
So talk about this. There's another way to look at this, too. We know about the racialized language, the coded language used to describe drug dealers to give the Americans the impression that most of this was happening neighborhoods which were minority neighborhoods. So that's part of it. Now we look at the statistics and we see that people are being arrested in far greater numbers than their statistics drug use. Okay, so there's some more data. But also, let's take a look at the way we're looking at heroin now and the rise in heroin addiction and overdose. Tell us about how that's also an indicator.
Well, what shocks me, having spent years studying the war on drugs, is that now we're talking about rehabilitating, we're talking about curing, we're talking about even medically supervised injection sites in the United States, and Ithaca talked about this. And I'm saying, what's going on here? Heroin is possessing heroin is a criminal offense. So if you're caught with a certain amount of heroin, you can spend 5 or 10 years in a federal prison. And now we're talking about white people who are using this. And now we're talking about rehabilitation, which goes back to one of the best generalizations that you can think of that we have when it comes to the war on drugs. It's not the drug itself. It's who is using the drug and how you feel about that person. It started back in the 1880s with the Chinese who were building our railroads, with their opium, etc.
This is why I've always wanted to rear a cop.
As we turn to Rikers Island and new revelations in the tragic case of Kalief Browder, who took his own life nearly a year ago on June 6, 2015. At the time of his death, Kalief was a 22-year-old New York student who spent 3 years at Rikers Island jail without being convicted of a crime. In 2010, when he was just 16, he was sent to Rikers Island without trial on suspicion of stealing a backpack. He spent the next nearly 3 years at Rikers, even though he was never tried or convicted. For nearly 800 days of that time, he was held in solitary confinement. Khalif always maintained his innocence, requesting a trial, but was only offered plea deals while the trial was repeatedly delayed. Near the end of his time in jail, the judge offered to sentence him to time served if he entered a guilty plea and told him he could face 15 years in prison if he went to trial and was convicted. Khalif still refused to accept the plea deal. He was only released when the case was dismissed. During Khalif Browder's time at Rikers, he struggled with depression and suicidal thoughts stemming from his incarceration. He attempted suicide multiple times. Now, in a new piece for The New Yorker magazine, Jennifer Gonerman details how Khalif actually learned how to commit suicide at Rikers after seeing another prisoner attempt to take his own life. The piece also details how, before taking his own life, Khalif recounted prison guards goading him on during suicide attempts, saying, quote, "If you don't jump, we're going to go in there anyway, so you might as well go ahead and jump. Go ahead and jump." These revelations in Khalif Browder's case come amidst increasing scrutiny of the infamous prison where currently 85% of the 10,000 prisoners at Rikers have not yet been tried. On Wednesday, The Intercept reported on the case of Jairo Pastoressa, who has been waiting nearly 6 years for a trial after having been arrested in 2010. Rikers also made headlines this week for the case of Ait Abdel Salem, who spent 5 months in Rikers because no one told him his bail was only $2. Well, to talk now about Khalif Browder's case and Rikers Island, we're joined once again by Jennifer Gonerman, reporter, author, contributing editor at The New Yorker magazine. She first recounted Khalif Browder's story in a 2014 article called Before the Law. A boy was accused of taking a backpack. The courts took the next 3 years of his life. Jennifer, welcome back to Democracy Now! Explain what you have learned since Khalif's suicide last year.
You know, the one-year anniversary of Khalif's suicide is coming up on Monday, which is June 6th. And I was planning to write about him and went and tracked down, managed to get three depositions that he gave in the last year of his life, in which he was interviewed by an attorney for New York City for hours at a stretch about his time in Rikers. And the last one that was conducted a year ago, May, focused largely on his suicide attempts in Rikers. And I didn't actually plan to write any more anything about these depositions. But as I was reading them, there were a few moments when I almost fell off my chair. I was just so disturbed by some of the revelations that I ended up having to write about it. And we published a story on The New Yorker's website yesterday that you just summarized.
Talk about those revelations.
Essentially, I mean, he doesn't use this phrase, but his description of Rikers and his time on Rikers was almost as if it were a school for suicide. You know, he had never attempted suicide before, never really thought about it before. He was arrested, and this is when he was 16. He went into the jail system, and this is the spring of 2010. At some point, he sees another adolescent boy in his jail down the cell block with a sheet tied around his neck who's just been taken out of his cell. He did not take his life, but he attempted. And so there was almost like a culture of suicide attempts that he was exposed to, and he started to internalize and think about a lot. And he spent much of his time, as you mentioned, in solitary confinement when he was locked up.
800 days.
And, you know, on Rikers, in many places, the only way—so it's a little bit complicated how the sort of world of—it was just completely upside down, you know, the world of Rikers. And the only way—there's sort of perception among officers, among some of the employees, that when a person attempts to harm themselves in solitary, that they're only doing it to get out of solitary, to get into general population, to fix their housing situation. So there's sort of this deep skepticism, and that's what you see coming through in the story. You know, obviously, Khalif is truly depressed and having sort of serious suicidal thoughts, but in that context, things aren't taken seriously, and it's just, you know, this is sort of what happens when we turn our, turn our jails into sort of mental hospitals almost.
I want to turn to Khalif Browder in his own words. This was December 2013 in an interview with HuffPost Live's Mark Lamont Hill. Browder talking about his suicide attempts at Rikers and his efforts to get psychiatric help.
I would say I committed suicide about five or six times.
Okay, you attempted suicide 5 to 6 times?
Yes.
While still in prison?
Yes.
Wow.
And I tried to resort to telling the correction officers that I wanted to see a psychiatrist or a counselor or something. I was telling them I need mental help because I wasn't feeling right. All the stress from my case, everything was just getting to me, and I just couldn't take it. I just needed somebody to talk to. I needed to just talk and be stress free. But the correction officers, they didn't want to hear me out. Nobody wanted to listen.
So that was Khalif soon after he was released from prison. And for people who haven't followed Khalif's story, Jennifer Gonerman, you've just done such an amazing job bringing his story to light. Explain again how he went to Rikers at the age of 16.
Sure. He was walking home from a party late one night in the Bronx, the spring of 2010. He was a sophomore in high school at the time, 16, just about to turn 17. And a police car drives up, and there's somebody in the backseat who points him out and says, you know, points to him and says that this young man and another person he was with had robbed him prior, you know, a week or two prior, and accused him of stealing his backpack. And that set in motion a chain of events. Khalif, you know, insisted that he was innocent. He was taken to the precinct. He says he was told, well, don't worry about it. We're just going to straighten a few things out, some paperwork. You'll be going home soon. So he thought it was just a sort of routine matter in which he would, you know, be getting home by the morning. And instead, it ended up turning into a three-year odyssey. And he was in this sort of perverse catch-22 situation where, in order to prove his innocence, he had to stay in jail and, as you mentioned, repeatedly refuse the prosecutor's plea offers because he said, I'm not guilty. I'm not going to plead to something that I didn't do. I want my trial. Where is my right to a trial? And what he didn't understand is that trials barely ever happen in the Bronx and across the country. Almost everybody gets out by pleading to something. But it was his insistence on his innocence and his insistence on not pleading to something that he said he had not done that kept him in jail all that time. And in the Bronx is notorious for a complete lack of sort of speedy trials, and the court delays are outrageous. And that's so it's, you know, dysfunction in the courts, dysfunction in the jail system. He's going back and forth between two of the most dysfunctional systems in New York City, and that's what led to him spending so much time locked up.
And then there were the beatings, the horror of the release of the video from inside the prison. As a guard escorts Khalif to the showers, Khalif appears to speak. And then the guard suddenly, violently hurls him to the floor as he's already handcuffed. In a separate video from 2010, he's attacked by almost a dozen other teenage prisoners after he punches a gang member who spat in his face. The other prisoners pile on Browder and pummel him until guards intervene. And that first one again, that image of the prison guard, you see him flexing his muscles before he takes Khalif out, and then he takes him down.
You know, the craziest thing is when I met Khalif not long after he got out of jail, he told me about this incident. He said, get the video. And I'm thinking, how am I possibly ever going to get that video? And the incident upset him so much, not because it was the worst thing that happened to him on Rikers, but because he knew it had happened in full view of the cameras and there had been no consequences for the officer. And he never got a chance to get any justice in that situation. And ultimately, in 2015, we did, the New Yorker did get this video. We did post it on our website. And I watched it with Khalif the first time he saw it. And it was just unbelievable. It was just unbelievable.
And so as we wrap up, talk about this latest piece, Khalif Browder Learned How to Commit Suicide on Rikers. The takeaway almost a year after Khalif did succeed in committing suicide.
You know, this piece that just came out on our website yesterday is actually part of a package, and the rest is going to be posted on the New Yorker's website today. We did an audio piece, a radio piece that'll be airing on the New Yorker Radio Hour, which is on NPR this weekend, also on our website today. And then you can hear Khalif talk about what it was like to be in solitary in his own words. And this is using interview tapes that I conducted with him back in 2014. And we also put together a video montage. You know, he's gotten a lot of attention in the months and the years since his death, but it doesn't detract from the fact that this was, you know, a straight-up American tragedy that never should have happened. And, you know, there have been some reform efforts on Rikers around the country. Obama cited Kalief when he talked about reducing the use of solitary in federal prisons. And there's been a number of other initiatives. But I think a year later, you know, as the attention has waned and time has gone on, there's also been a lack of urgency about these same issues. And I thank you, Amy, for, you know, keeping his story alive here on Democracy Now.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
Grosse Pointe High School, students under fire for the second racist social media post that surfaced within the last few months. 7 Action News reporter Aaron Baskerville is live in Grosse Pointe tonight with the very latest on this one. Aaron?
Stephen, a letter was sent out to South High School parents today alerting them to that racist video making the rounds on social media, the school district calling it deplorable. That letter talks about a handful of Grosse Pointe teens, including 3 South students, choosing to record a video making offensive and racist comments against blacks over the weekend. It also talks about consequences, including, quote, student separations from school. In the video, we saw a student is talking about making blacks slaves in order to get alcohol. As we know, in March, 6 students from South High were suspended 5 days after a photo on social media showed some with the N-word scribbled on their stomachs. Well, tonight we caught up with the co-founder of the NAACP in the Grosse Pointe in Harper Woods, and also some students who can't believe what they saw.
It's just crazy, and it's terrible that someone would actually say that, let alone put it out there and put it on social media. I didn't think he would do it. I've only met him a couple of times. He didn't seem like the kid that would, and I'm surprised. Especially what happened in March, that was pretty mind-blowing.
5 years ago, 6 years ago, 7 years ago, people would have said, oh, this is no big deal. It's just, you know, kids saying what they're going to say, blah, 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 and not taking into account the fact that other people are hurt by it.
Well, once again, the school district is taking this very seriously. A news conference is scheduled for tomorrow morning at the administration building for 9 o'clock. For now, we're live in Grosse Pointe Farms. Aaron Baskerville, 7 Action News.
My conscience won't let me go shoot my brother or some darker people or some poor hungry people in the mud for big, powerful America and shoot them for what? They never called me nigger. They never lynched me. They never put no dogs on me. They never robbed me of my nationality, rape and kill my mother and father. What, I'm going to shoot them for what? How can I go shoot them? Them little poor little black people, little babies and children and women. How can I shoot them poor people? I'll just take me to jail.
Tina Foley moved her children out of Chicago, trying to keep them safe from the violence that's become all too common here. But her 15-year-old son was attacked over the weekend while swimming with friends in Canton. Now, that's a town about 30 miles from Peoria.
As Eyewitness News anchor Shel Burton tells us tonight, police say that the attackers were using racial slurs.
Well, Kathy and Alan, the victim suffered only minor physical injuries, but the attack has shaken his entire family. The suspects are a mother and her 2 sons, and tonight they are now charged with a hate crime.
Come on, you guys, get up!
No.
Hey, come on!
No.
It happened Sunday afternoon. The 15-year-old African-American student was swimming with friends when he was confronted by a group of people.
They started beating him up and held him underwater until he pretty much was not breathing.
Tonight, 42-year-old Carrie Weller and her 2 sons are charged with battery, mob action, and a hate crime. Weller and her son Corey were arrested shortly after the incident. 19-year-old Shane Weller was just taken into custody tonight. The Foleys are stunned to think this could happen where they live.
I'm proud to be from Illinois because I tell people from Alabama, you know, it's not like that up there. And hell, here I got a video of some people trying to drown my brother, call him the N-word.
Nigga!
Well, the Foleys are hoping to bring awareness to this attack to make sure that something like this never happens again in Canton, Alan and Kathy.
Okay. Right, Cheryl, thank you.
I'm saying you're talking about me about some draft, and all of you white boys are breaking your neck to get to Switzerland and Canada and London. I'm not going to help nobody get something my Negroes don't have. If I'm going to die, I'll die now right here fighting you. If I'm going to die, you my enemy. My enemy is the white people, not Viet Congs or Chinese or Japanese. You my opposer when I want freedom. You my opposer when I want justice. You my opposer when I want equality. You won't even stand up for me in America for my religious beliefs, and you want me to go somewhere and fight, but you won't even stand up for me here at home.
Airbnb's motto is simple.
Live there. Even if it's just for a night.
But for one guest, that wasn't the case. This week, a Northwestern University business student was trying to book a room with the home sharing website for job training in Charlotte. When the host, Todd Warner, realized the guest was an African-American woman, he canceled her reservation, followed by a series of racial slurs. In one message, Warner calls her the N-word, saying, "This is the South, darling. Find another place to rest your head."
It's just truly unsettling, right? Not only for her, but for anyone. No one should have to endure this.
I talked with one of her classmates on the phone who wants to remain anonymous. He says he's simply shocked by what happened to her.
Our classmate was just trying to find a place to lay her head so that she could go to work. And her safety was compromised. Her dignity absolutely compromised by this situation.
Similar stories of discrimination were shared on social media with the hashtag #AirbnbWhileBlack. And last year, a Harvard University study found that Airbnb hosts are less likely to rent to guests with black-sounding names. On Wednesday afternoon, Airbnb took action. Their CEO and co-founder tweeted, "The incident in North Carolina was disturbing and unacceptable. Racism and discrimination have no place on Airbnb. We have permanently banned this host." Airbnb says they're also offering unconscious bias training for all their hosts through webinars and even some in-person trainings. But her classmate says that's not enough.
What is stopping Todd from creating another email account or getting another phone number to be rejoining the community? Are there other ways that they can verify users to make sure that these discriminatory practices don't take place?
Despite what happened, her classmate says she's holding up well. In Charlotte, Kirsten Garris, Time Warner Cable News.
And Gus, you had said before during that program we did about the numbers and how they mentioned 88% of the American people were in favor of the purge. And I think you said that when you look at the census, black people are about 12 or 13%. So who is that 88%? And something else, too, that was mentioned to me by someone, and that was, I think Hushai Prince mentioned that when you look at the purge, the chairman's address, I mean, look at the website, the chairman's address is dated to 2022. It says that 6 years ago when the purge started, that would be 2016, the last year of the Obama administration. How that plays in, what the thinking is on that, I don't know.
Jonathan Cruz, charged with three murders and two armed robberies in what prosecutors call
went on a four-day, one-man purge.
Cruz even allegedly posting on social media about his purging, referring to the 2013 movie about killing without consequence. But there will be consequences here, prosecutors say. Here on Linwood, where two of the killings happened.
We just haven't heard anything else about what's going on with it.
They did today make an arrest.
Oh, did they?
Some relief.
This is a real high crime area.
We've not had any shots fired runs in this area.
But that changed early morning May 12th. Victim Billy Boyd found murdered in the street at 39th and College. 3 hours later, victim Jay Higginbotham found gunned down in the 900 block of Denny. Court papers say two men in a car stopped near Higginbotham, who was walking, tried to fight him, and then when the victim tried to leave, Cruz allegedly shot him, then went through his pockets and shouted a racial slur before driving off.
Nigga!
Then 3 days later, the third murder, Jose Ruiz found shot to death in his car. But this time, police got a break. They found an informant.
In court papers, the informant told police Cruz was their drug dealer. He allegedly told them, quote, about shooting and robbing several people. Cruz told them he had been purging. Police would later find text messages between Cruz and his girlfriend. Cruz allegedly saying, quote, you better go on Facebook and watch the videos of me shooting people. I purge every night now. Since I am dying, someone else has to. And that night of the first murder, Cruz allegedly messaging someone he needed more bullets. Quote, because I got to go out there and rob somebody or something tonight, bro. Minutes after the shooting, he allegedly messaged that he'd, quote, pop someone for no reason. Quote, he didn't have nothing in his pockets. back on Linwood, learning there's a suspect.
I think it's great, you know, they're, you know, coming down and finding the people and taking care of it, makes people feel safer.
Improve the neighborhood.
Yeah, exactly.
Blessed be America for letting us purge and cleanse our souls.
Won the Olympic gold medal in Rome, Italy. Olympic champion, the Russian standing right here, and the Pole right here. Is Poland considered a communist country?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm defeating America's so-called threats or enemies. And the flag is going, ton, 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 ton. I'm standing so proud. Ton, 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 ton. And I done whooped the world for America. Ton, 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 ton. I took my gold medal, thought I'd invented something. I said, man, I know I'm going to get my people freedom there. I'm the champion of the whole world, Olympic champion. I know I can eat downtown now. And I went downtown that day, had my big old medal on, and went in the restaurants. At that time, black things weren't integrated. The black folks couldn't eat downtown. And I went downtown, and I sat down, and I said, you know, a cup of coffee, hot dog. He said, the lady said, we don't serve Negroes.
The countdown to the Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro this August has revealed one challenge after another for the host country. Brazil is in the middle of an economic and political meltdown. There's the threat of the Zika virus. And in Rio, there has been a spike in crime. That's meant more funerals, like the one NPR's Lulu Garcia Navarro takes us to now. She says people in the city worry about what will happen after the games end.
In the misty rain surrounded by Rio's green hills, Officer Eduardo Diaz was buried last week. He was shot purportedly by gang members as he was leaving his post inside the favela or shantytown where he worked as a community cop. The killing took place only a few hundred feet away from the Maracanã Stadium, where the opening ceremony of the Olympics will be held. As family members wept by the graveside, the pastor raised his hands.
A impressão que a gente tem.
This rain is like our tears, he said, not just ours, but coming also from the heavens for everything that we are going through. I've been asking God, until when, my Lord? Until when are we going to have to bury our good policemen? Until when are we going to have to keep burying our children, he asked. Rio is in a security crisis. Murders are up 15% from last year. Robbery is up 30%. Brazil's economic and political turmoil has meant the state security budget has been cut by a third, so there are fewer cops out on the streets. And the gangs are taking advantage, fighting for territory in advance of the Olympics, say experts. Rio's poorest communities, called favelas, are being particularly hard hit. To get a sense of how far things have slipped, I went back to a community I visited when I first arrived in Rio.
So I'm climbing up an endless amount of stairs. Babylonia, like many favelas in Rio de Janeiro, is located on a hillside with an amazing view of the water, which is right next to the famed Copacabana Beach, and it's a real tourist draw. But that's changed now.
This is one of the communities dubbed a Disneyland favela because it was where visiting dignitaries and the media came to see how much things had improved. Police walked around with their guns holstered. Residents were opening up businesses, catering to tourists. The drug gangs kept a low profile. This was my report in 2013 on how peaceful some of Rio de Janeiro's most conflict-ridden areas had become.
A new boutique hotel perched on top of one of Rio's previously most dangerous favelas is about to open. And yes, there's a jazz club and yoga too.
All that came courtesy of a bold policing program called Pacification, which placed permanent bases of community police, called UPPs, in neighborhoods that had never had any state presence in advance of the Olympics and the World Cup. In Babylonia these days, there are over 100 UPP officers.
We're on patrol with the Pacification Police. Unlike the last time I was here, this time the police are walking around with their guns drawn, pistols at the ready, very different type of patrol.
UPP Commander Paulo Barat takes me to the crest of the hill, where muddy paths disappear into the jungle. He tells me 6 weeks ago, a rival gang from the neighboring favela tried to push in and take control from the group that's in charge of the drugs and guns in Babylonia. Three drug dealers were killed in the firefight. It sent shockwaves and fear through the community. So much so that we had to leave Babylonia to speak with residents and business owners about what was going on.
Rodrigo da Silva owns a hostel in the community that he advertises on Airbnb, but he sells food on the beaches to make ends meet. He tells me he had hoped the Olympics would get him out of the hot sun and backbreaking work, but so far there have been few guests. Other members of the favela had similar stories, saying revenue had dropped at least 50% because of the violence. Other than Rodrigo, though, all refused to be interviewed, in marked contrast to years ago. Several told me they had been directly threatened by the gangs, who had been informed we were asking too many questions. If you talk too much, it ends badly, Da Silva tells me. Here's the deal. You do not mess with their business. You don't mess with their stuff, and they don't mess with yours, he says.
There's a sense now of creeping anxiety and dread.
That's Robert Mugga, who studies security and development at the Igarapé Institute in Rio.
So in contrast to the, let's call it the great enthusiasm in this experiment, probably one of the most extraordinary policing experiments in the world, today we're seeing a real sense of gloom. The pacification is just maybe not working the way it ought to.
Olympic officials are promising the Games will be safe for visitors and athletes. Brazil will be bringing in double the amount of security that the London Summer Games had. But what happens after the Olympics is unclear, and the future of pacification is in doubt. Back on the beach, Rodrigo da Silva tells me he fears the worst. There will be more violence in all the communities because of the fights between the drug gangs, the fights against the police, he says. In the end, the ones who will pay for all this will be the residents, he says. As always, Lulu Garcia Navarro, NPR News, Rio de Janeiro.
No matter what you think of Mr. Muhammad Ali's religion, you certainly have to admire his courage. For here is a young man willing to give up fame if necessary, willing to give up millions of dollars in order to stand up for what conscience tells him is right. Blessed are ye when men shall persecute you, and shall call you all manner of evil. For righteousness' sake, rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward.
Absolutely. Dr. Harry Edwards is a noted sociologist, professor emeritus from Cal Berkeley. He's known for his noted commentary on a wide range of issues, but particularly those that affect the African-American community. Dr. Edwards, we appreciate the time.
Thank you very much for having me.
First of all, you were coming of age at the same time Muhammad Ali was. What was that time like for a black man in America watching Muhammad Ali?
Well, he wasn't Muhammad Ali initially when I first met him. I first met him when I was a freshman at San Jose State University. Julio Menendez was the boxing coach and of the Olympics for the Rome Olympics in 1960, and he had the boxing team practicing at San Jose State, and that was the first time I met Cassius Clay. And subsequently, of course, when I organized the Olympic Project for Human Rights, one of the demands that we made was that his boxing access and so forth license be given back to him after he had been deprived of that for refusing to be inducted into the military. And then, of course, when I was at Cornell University, 1969, we invited him up to speak. I spent the day with him there, so I had contact with him from the time I was about 17 years old up until I had really come of age in the late 1960s.
Yes.
So I got to know him. I got to know him fairly well. I also, coming out of East St. Louis, having been associated with Dr. King literally 2 months before he was assassinated, having spent some time with Malcolm X about 6 months before he was assassinated. I wrote my master's thesis on the black Muslim family and talked to some of the people in Malcolm's group in New York City while I was at Cornell. I was working with students with Bobby Kennedy on Bobby Kennedy's election. He was anti-war, and we were all anti-war. And then before he got to the Bay Area, he was assassinated. But then, you know, my 21st birthday was November 22nd, 1963. So it was a difficult time. It was a time of growing up real fast, and I think Ali became a focus for a lot of us during that period.
We saw him evolve as a man from his initial more radical views when he was with the Nation of Islam to his his more peace-loving standpoint later on when he embraced traditional Islam, worldwide Islam. But we also saw the perception of Muhammad Ali change from being booed in 1971 at Madison Square Garden before he fought Joe Frazier to the widely loved person that he became. How did that evolution occur?
Well, I think that, first, I don't think that Ali ever was seriously bothered by people who didn't like him, because he was aware, as were many people during that generation, he was 2 years older than I am, that we were disliked, widely disliked in American society simply because we were black. So that wasn't something that you got excited about. I think that what happened over a period of time is that people came to understand what motivated him, the kinds of issues that he was concerned about, and the fact that he put everything on the line to articulate those issues. And he didn't just articulate them for himself. He really didn't just articulate issues for Black America. He had articulated issues for humanity in a very definitive sense. He was the quintessential humanitarian, especially during the his post boxing years. I've always had a problem with him referring to himself as the greatest, and with other people referring to him as the greatest. That's the way he's going to be remembered. I've studied athletes. I've been around great athletes. Kareem, of course, Bill Russell, Jim Brown. I know very well Jerry Rice, Ronnie Lott, all of these great athletes I know. And if they were all in a room, they would be they would come over to pay respect to Muhammad Ali. And then in the social part of it, the political part of it, he was the father of the modern athlete, the modern athlete who stood up, spoke out for issues beyond the athletic arena. He moved sports out of the arena of the tar Department of Human Affairs. Greatest doesn't really capture him. It's not big enough. It doesn't do him justice. So to say that he's the greatest, that really doesn't get it done.
And I look at even hip-hop culture that we see today, and you look at his brashness, his way with words, and you could say he was one of the pioneers who helped create the hip-hop culture.
Absolutely. He penetrated every dimension of American culture. He was the difference in terms of the athletes of the 1960s. He was not Joe Louis. Smith and Carlos were not Jesse Owens. Kurt Flood was not Jackie Robinson. Bill Russell was not the Harlem Globetrotters. Arthur Ashe, you know, was a unique individual. But framing it all up, the one who really projected and started that, legitimized that, was Muhammad Ali. To call him the greatest compared to what? There's no comparison. I mean, you can name all of the athletes and one after the other, and then you say Ali, and they just kind of fade away. So the greatest compared to what? That doesn't capture it. I'm sorry, that doesn't capture it. And I've been wrestling with what word would capture his legacy, would capture the man. And just between you and me, I mean, I have an Ivy League PhD from Cornell. I haven't been able to come up with one.
All right, Dr. Edwards, we certainly appreciate your time and your perspective.
Thank you.
We start today remembering a man who was many things: an activist, a draft resister, a showman, a butterfly, a bee, a champion. Muhammad Ali. He died last night at age 74. Ali was 3-time world heavyweight boxing champ, and maybe his most famous fight, people will debate this, but maybe the most famous was the so-called Rumble in the Jungle, held in Kinshasa, in the country then known as Zaire. In front of a crowd of 60,000, Muhammad Ali stole back the world heavyweight title.
This is an incredible scene. The place is going wild. Muhammad Ali has won by a knockdown.
The man he knocked down was another boxing titan, George Foreman. We called Foreman today to ask how he remembers that fight. George Foreman, it's great to speak to you. I'm sorry it's under these circumstances.
Yeah, I've lost a giant tree just fell, and Muhammad Ali, there'll never be another.
Tell me, you know, I think probably the most famous moment that many of us will remember was the Rumble in the Jungle, where the two of you were in the ring back in 1974. Take us back to that and what it is like to step into the ring with Muhammad Ali.
It was a strange event because I had beaten Joe Frazier, who, of course, had beaten Muhammad Ali. I knocked out Ken Norton, who had beaten him. So this, for me, I thought would be the easiest money I'd ever get in boxing.
And you were wrong.
Yeah, boy, I got into the ring, and I hit him with everything I had. He survived, and after about six rounds, he started whispering, "That all you got, George? Show me something, George." And I knew this was a frightful moment, and I kept thinking I've gotten myself into more than I realized.
How many times did the two of you meet? How many times did you fight?
Muhammad Ali and I fought once. I lost the world heavyweight title to him. We never fought again.
That was it, the one time.
And that was enough for me.
Yeah, I can see that. I saw you tweeted today, Ali, Frazier, and Foreman, we were one guy.
That's true. And I realized a part of me slipped away, and I call it the greatest part, Muhammad Ali, because it was he who made me glimpse into boxing. Same with Frazier. We looked into boxing by way of Muhammad Ali, and then there we were talking about each other, boasting about each other, trying to knock one another out. We were one fellow. We really were. My life is never going to be the same without having to look to the left seeing, did Muhammad hear my interview? What did he have to say about that photograph? It's gone now. A piece of me is gone forever.
What did you learn from him as a boxer?
What I learned from Muhammad Ali is that he was one of the most conditioned athletes in the world. But to put him down as a boxer would be really not good because he was bigger than boxing, bigger than sports, as a matter of fact. He went into the ring and he didn't lose because he was fighting for a lot more than just a championship belt and a few dollars in his pocket. He had a cause. He really had a cause.
What kind of legacy do you think he leaves for young guys getting into the sport today, young boxers now?
He left a legacy that for all athletes, I heard him say he wanted to be more than just a boxer. And let me tell you, he was. And most everyone, he's going to leave a message. Be more than just what you do.
We've been talking to people on the show today, and I'm hearing a lot of people say he left a legacy as a boxer, also as a trailblazer for African-Americans.
Don't put him in that little pocket of once. The man was a great man beyond anything as far as color. You go to Europe, you see guys could put on a better imitation of Muhammad Ali than someone from Louisville, Kentucky. And I sold worldwide over 120 million George Foreman grills. And I traveled the world and people whisper in my ear from every corner of the earth, Ali, Ali. I said, oh, my goodness, over here, too? He was the greatest. He was the greatest. And most of them never saw a boxing match.
But they knew who he was.
They knew who he was. When you say the word Ali, it would do something to your heart and make you feel a certain thing.
George Foreman, thank you for talking to us, and I'm sorry for the loss of your dear friend.
Thank you so much.
I have wrestled with an alligator. I done tussled with a whale. I done handcuffed lightning, throw thunder in jail. That's bad. Only last week, I murdered a rock, injured a stone, hospitalized a brick. I'm so mean, I make medicine sick.
Bad dude.
Bad.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, June 4th, 2016. So I have been told with all the things that have happened the past 24 hours. Tough. We had major technical difficulties. And I think at least this time the listeners can attest to the problems because it would seem like it was not just Gus that had issues. Something happened with just the whole free conference call HD line. Just stopped working, massive malfunctions. I think it started with the audio clip not playing. And then I tried to, I thought it might have just been my line. I didn't know if I had a connection problem or something of that nature. So I tried to just disconnect myself and dial back in. I wasn't able to dial back in. And then I started getting messages from other people that they, too, got disconnected and were not able to dial back in. They were getting all kinds of crazy error messages and things of that nature. I even tried to call for tech assistance because that, you know, we have had tech issues before where I've called them to try to see if they could figure out what was happening because it was something on their end. And I couldn't even get through for technical assistance. So it took about 40 minutes for me to just figure out what a massive issue I was trying to navigate. And then once all that, I figured out that that was not going to work. Just tried to go to see if there was something else that I could figure out to resurrect the broadcast as best I could. So we went to the backup alternative, which is what we are on now. For folks who are listening to the archives, it'll won't make any difference. It'll be fine. But for people that are listening live, if you are on Facebook, if you're on Twitter, if you do any of the social media stuff, you can retweet, you can share the updated information so that if you have friends, people that follow you on social media, they'll get the temporary number that we're using today. I hope, you know, the normal number, the free HD line is back up and working for our broadcast coming up this week. But if not, we do have the backup in place. But if you want to share the information, please do so. I updated it on my Facebook page and on Twitter as well. I'm on Twitter at Until Justice, at Until Justice. And the number for today, temporary information, is 712-770-4010. And the code is 425022. And I'll give that information again. 712-770-4010. The access code is 425022. Again, it's on the Facebook page. I tweeted it out as well. If you weren't able to write it down, I'll probably give it out a few more times during the broadcast. If folks want to write that down that way, if you want to listen on the phone, you can do so. Certainly, this is still our compensatory call-in, so if you want to dial in and share any views, observations, you can do that as well. And I think it is the same procedure, even though I've only – this is like I think the second time that I have done this. I don't think I ever used this format before. I think they just told me this the last. In the meantime, while they were trying to figure things out, and I don't. This is, like I said, the second time that I've used it. So, but I think the procedure is the same. That if you call in and you would like to participate, press *6, and we'll be able to get your hand on the line. It looks like I think Thomas in New York. Looks like he did what he normally does, press a *6 so I can see his hand. So I think it's the same procedure. If you press *6, I'll be able to see your hand on the line, and we can get you on to share your thoughts, observations. Other things, yep, looks like other people are trying it out. So, yeah, that is the procedure. Feel free, press *6, and we'll get you on the line if you have commentary you would like to share. And, again, folks, if you could share the link if you're on any of the social media sites, Facebook, Twitter, all that stuff, you can just retweet or hit the share button so that other people can get the updated temporary information. And, again, hopefully it will just be today. This won't be a long-term situation. All righty. Quick things before I get some of the folks who dialed in who have a hand up on the line. I know we will not get everybody that we had. I certainly know we won't get everyone that we had who was listening on the Free HD line, just folks. I know everybody doesn't do Facebook and all that stuff, so everybody just won't have access to the information. The archive will be there for folks to be able to hear without interruption. I know it took about 30 minutes for about 40 minutes for me to figure out exactly what the nature of the problem was and to get things corrected. So shame we missed out on other folks, because we had a lot of other people that won the other line who got bumped off, and just the confusion of not knowing what the problem was with the passing of Muhammad Ali certainly has forced a lot of conversation on racism, white supremacy. Pretty difficult to talk about his life and times without talking about racism, white supremacy. I tweeted out after the program, the book study session yesterday evening, because I had been seeing reports throughout the week that, you know, he was having some health issues, and they were reporting Thursday and Friday that they had grave concerns that, you know, he might not recuperate. And he transitioned late Friday evening, a little bit after our broadcast went off the air. And I just started watching ESPN. I think I first saw it on Fox News. I was happened to be in front of a television. They had it on Fox News, and they were talking about him. And I turned to ESPN, and they had, you know, lots of coverage, Floyd Mayweather and, you know, all the prominent folks, athletes and what have you. And I think this is the first time ever that I've seen ESPN where they did not even take commercial breaks. They broadcasted for about, I think, about an hour and a half with no commercials, and just talking about his life and times. And I played the snippet that was Dr. Harry Edwards, who has been a guest on the Context of White Supremacy. They had him and lots of other folks. I even have to give credit to Stephen A. Smith, who I know a lot of people criticize and, you know, say that he doesn't exactly give the most constructive commentary on ESPN on a regular basis, but he is a victim of racism, a black male. But I thought he did give some great insight yesterday. In fact, he mentioned a stream of black journalists that were impacted by Muhammad Ali, Michael Wilbon and William C. Roden and Gil Noble. In fact, he encouraged folks to go to YouTube and check out Gil Noble Like It Is with Muhammad Ali. It's about an hour segment, which is phenomenal. I played a couple snippets during the audio session this week. People listening to archives are fine, but people listening live, I played a few sections that I hope people were able to hear. But it's just tremendous, lots of great information. You can check it out. As I said, it's on YouTube. It's about an hour long. But just quickly, the segment from NPR that was pretty much the last audio segment before all the news clips ended, where they had the white female at NPR, and she was doing the interview, and she said that she was talking about when Muhammad Ali and George Foreman fought in 1974. She said that he stole racists, they're going to be on their job. We've talked about this all year long. As soon as a black person dies, particularly if they were focused and did something with their time and energy, their life, to fight against racism, they're really going to go to town working hard to distort, to obfuscate your legacy, to bury things that they don't want people to think about or know about, and then to play up or distort things in terms of how you will be thought of, how people will remember you. I seriously doubt when they talk about Babe Ruth or any number of other white athletes, Wayne Gretzky when he passes away, or Joe Montana or Tom Brady, some of the other, Lou Gehrig or any other prominent athlete, a white athlete that is held up and revered for what they did in the sport, Rocky Marciano. I don't think that they talk about them as thieves for any of their accomplishments in their respective fields. It's Muhammad Ali went to Africa and stole a championship. Just really, really tacky and, you know, to be expected. I said yesterday, I think this is a time that we should invest as much time and energy as we can studying the life and times of Muhammad Ali so that we are more informed about what he did, his legacy, what have you. I don't think I heard Elijah Muhammad's name mentioned very often over the past 24 hours, and it seems he certainly had a major impact on Muhammad Ali's understanding of racism, white supremacy, as well as Malcolm X. I've heard his name mentioned a few times, but not as much as, you know, people like Howard Cosell and other folks over the past 24 hours. And I recommended, I said that there is a book, Blood Brothers, which I have mentioned before on this program. I've played an audio segment that was talking with the author of the book. Maybe that should be our next book for the book club, Blood Brothers. It is about the friendship between Minister Malcolm X, Muhammad Ali, and that friendship falling apart, and Muhammad Ali's regrets. It seems like that was something that he did have a lot of regrets around, not being able to repair things with Minister Malcolm before his assassination in 65. But maybe down the road, we still have a good way to go with medical apartheid, but maybe that's a book that we can do next for the book club. Blood Brothers is the title. I also posted that on Facebook over the last 24 hours or so. With that, there were a few other things I was going to get to, but I will pause here again. Massive appreciation to folks who were patient, the folks that dialed in, got the information and called in on the temporary line that we're using today, and folks that are listening in. You can listen in at Black Talk Radio Network or tune in, all of that stuff. I had that's been on and working for about the last hour or so. So you can certainly use that if you want to listen in online or what have you to stream the content. But major appreciation for all the folks being patient with the huge errors that we had to, or just problems we had to navigate today. That is a part of counter-racism. Given the loss we suffered the last 24 hours and this year in total, this kind of puts things in perspective. But, you know, still, thanks to everyone for being patient, and I hope it's worthy of your time and energy. I will give out the number again, folks, if you would like to participate. It is 712-770-4010. What? And the code is 425-022. And you need to press pound, sorry about that, for the code. So the number is 712-770-4010, and then the code is 425-022-pound. It should say, remind you to make sure you press that. But once you do that, it's the same procedure. Press *6 if you would like to participate. I think some other folks have already tried it. Looks like it works as usual. *6, and I see your hand on the switchboard if you would like to chime in. My timing is distorted because we started on time. We had the massive disruption with things, so my time is kind of thrown off in terms of where we would be at and all that, and the show is just kind of disrupted. So I will get the folks who dialed in with a hand up. I'm not really sure about the length of the program because it caused such a disruption with things. I'm just a little discombobulated. We'll just have to see how it goes. If you are interested in chiming in and participating, this would be one I would encourage folks to not lollygag, because I did have questions that I wanted to ask people. But as I said, we lost so many callers in particular just because of the disruption. I'm not sure if the full audience will be here for me to be able to ask some of the questions that I wanted to get to. But we'll make do, compensate as we go. So all the people who dialed in with a hand up should be with us. We should have Thomas in New York. Let's see. I think Roz, retired firefighter in Florida. I will nab other hands as I see them.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to Roz and retired firefighter and everyone else who calls in. We have a few comments to make about the clips, but first I wanted to say very good correlation. I didn't even think of that. He stole the championship, you know. And, kind of makes me, I was telling my wife last night, man, I wish that, I hate to say it, but I wish that something was just to happen to Bill Cosby before they destroy him. I mean, I could just, Ali, greatest athlete ever, because he risked it all to be vocal against racism, white supremacy. And for that, they destroy him. They put him in jail. I mean, he had it bad. He was hated. And to this day, I think he serves as the example of what would happen if other athletes try to take a political stance. I think that's why you don't see Michael Jordan or LeBron, even though he has done a little, but I'm saying too much because they don't want to end up like Ali. You know, let's not forget that whites hated, I mean, absolutely hated Ali. All this love that they're giving him, it's all fake. They've been giving it to him for a while now, ever since he's been incapacitated. But from that ever, from everyone I know, they hated him. In the year 2000, I remember, he was the most recognizable person on the planet, more known than even at the time, Bill Clinton and other prominent whites, known on every continent. Ali also got hostages released that were held by so-called Islamic jihadist terrorists. I think that, you know, if you had to say in the sense of, you know, the ancient Egyptians, I mean, he's a modern-day god. You know, they would have statues and carvings on the wall all about him. Another great loss for this year. Came out that Prince was addicted to fentanyl, which I find to be unimaginable. Fentanyl is 50 times stronger than morphine, and 100 times stronger than morphine, and 50 times more strong than heroin. And I can't see him shooting this up and getting on the elevator and really thinking he could get off the elevator. It just doesn't make sense to me. This is almost as crazy as, let's say, Mike was addicted to propanol. You know, I've been under anesthesia. I can't imagine anyone wanting to be addicted to that. That just doesn't make sense either. And I think that there's definitely something going on there. The gorilla, that was a great clip you played. That lady said it all. And her bringing up Tamir Rice in contrast is excellent. You know, I saw footage of a white kid that fell in the gorilla enclave a few years ago, and the gorilla killed the little white kid, little white boy, little blonde-headed, blue-eyed white boy on top of that. Killed him. All you could see was his head hanging and the gorilla holding it. It was a much smaller gorilla on top of that. And all they did was shot a water hose at the gorilla, and he ran away and left the little white boy 5 years. And I can't imagine doing anything other than this if this was to happen. First thing is the zoo should have no way that anyone can get to a dangerous animal. I just don't see that this is the parents' fault. I mean, things happen, accidents happen, the kids slip away from you. And for them to be ridiculed, it's only because they're black, no other reason. This was a white kid that fell in there and they shot the gorilla, we wouldn't even be talking about this right now. The clip you played on drug seizures and cops. I would like for everyone to watch a documentary called The 75. It's about a precinct in New York City, and a lot of the corruption and stuff that the cops do. Where is that documentary going to death on it? It shows like pathology. And that was just a very good clip. It unveiled a lot. And the last thing I wanted to say was Rio de Janeiro, the clip you played about that. Knocking down the favelas. You know, same thing happened in Jersey City when I grew up in Newark, and I bet in Chicago. I went to Chicago in 95, and they were knocking down the projects then. And they did the same thing in Newark. If you look at Everything's Gonna Be All Right video with Naughty by Nature, Prince Street and Avon Street, all those projects are gone. In Jersey City, they've been knocking down the projects since I was still living there. And they're about complete now. It's only about one or two left, and I think they're going to keep those up for senior citizens or whatever. But the crime is crazy when you do that. Neighborhoods already have a hierarchy. You can't put thousands of new people there and expect for everyone just to get along, and you add in, you know, the gangs and the guns and everything else, it's just gonna be terrible. So I could imagine what they're going through in Brazil, because that's 20 times the size of anything we got here. And Gus, did you see the roots?
The band or the miniseries?
The miniseries.
No, I did not.
Okay. I just wanted to know if anyone had saw it, because I wanted to make some comments about it, but I could wait until later. And thank you very much.
I don't know. Just with the Cincinnati Zoo shooting, Harambe, the zoo official said that the area where the gorilla was contained, that it's been basically set up the way that it was when this young four-year-old fell in. It's been set up the same way since, they said, I think in the 70s, that it's been that way for a considerable time, and they haven't had any incidents before, because some people did raise that concern, that, you know, how, you know, there must be a problem if this can be set up where a four-year-old can get in there anyway, that this must be a problem. And I guess their official said, well, you know, it's been like this for this long, and we haven't had a problem up until now. So, you know, apparently they are making some changes to the setup, but that was a line that was given over the past, I guess, however long it's been, close to a week now, I think, since the zoo shooting happened. Other folks who had a hand up who had commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus, to Thomas in New York, and all the callers. I just want to say I was just pretty angry that the racists destroyed the program this evening. I was agitated, and it was actually thanks to Thomas in New York. He actually reached out to me with the new information so I could call in this evening. But I was just really agitated when that happened because I was looking forward to it. So I'm glad everything was worked out, even though I could totally understand it throwing off your equilibrium and stuff. So hopefully, you know, you'll get that, acquire that over the course of the program. I wanted to speak to Harambe the gorilla as well. I just felt like white people's rhetorical ethic was on full display, and I think it's a brilliant exhibition of that. And the woman who spoke about Tamir Rice, I think, said it best. There's really nothing I can add to that, because she said everything that I thought about when this happened the way it did. And you know, it's just typical white people. A dog's life is worth more than black people. A squirrel's life is worth more than niggers and squirrels. I'll put it as that. It's just crazy. So I just felt it was a brilliant display, a welding and Dr. Marimba Adni moment, I would say, as far as the rhetorical ethic with that. Thomas talked about Prince's passing and the situation with the fentanyl. So I won't speak on that. He did a brilliant job. Muhammad Ali, I would say, for me, wow, he was probably, as a matter of fact, he's one of the first athletes that I learned about. My dad gave me, remember when I was about maybe 7 years old, my dad had given me a book on Muhammad Ali. There was a book he gave me on Martin Luther King, and I believe Frederick Douglass. It was three of them, and he was the first athlete I actually read about, and I remembered, like, watching some of his matches before, so he really had a heavy impact on me as far as boxing, and when I learned about what he had done throughout his life as far as fighting against racism, white supremacy, and his stance on the Vietnam War, just really made me admire him even more as far as just that impact, and I'm sure there's millions of other people around the world that he had the same impact on their lives or in some form or fashion or another. And he was just brilliant. And I believe, just like, I don't know who it was that was speaking about him, but he's absolutely correct. The greatest is, there is no word I could think of either to really describe him. He was just a unique individual. I found it really sad, too, in reference to the situation with Minister Malcolm and their inability to really reconcile that before Minister Malcolm was assassinated. So that really was something. So maybe in the ancestral world, they'll be able to reconnect and facilitate that in some form or fashion. Also, I did want to say I did get to mini series Roots. The reason I watched it is because I have a feeling, because I remember when it came out when I was a child, we actually were forced to watch it via school. So we had, like, discussions about it, things like that. So I'm figuring probably a lot of young people are going to be asked to watch it and then comment on it in school in some form or fashion. And I wanted to really understand what young people would be exposed to, so that if I get into conversations with young people about that, I can maybe further correct maybe some of the inconsistencies there, or facilitate their understanding of racism, white supremacy, via what they saw in the film. And I was actually talking with Thomas earlier today about it, and I said to him, I said, it's really interesting that the black actors in the movie were able to play in these scenes that were very visceral, as far as the sexual conduct, as far as the rape of the black female, and just the utter terrorism that black people went through. And they're playing such poignant and visceral scenes. And somewhere in there, they're not able to recognize that those white actors are the same people that actually did that stuff, and not make the correlation that there's no difference between these people who are acting and what those actors actually think about them, and the way just the people who they're portraying, what they had to do to portray these characters as well. So I just found that very telling. And I told Thomas that, I said, I wonder if they've been thinking about that, that these are the same people, same type of people, the same mentality. And it's just, you know, we have Donald Trump at the helm, you know, and moving forward at a full, you know, full pace with racism, white supremacy. So that is, to me, one of the most important things, if anyone's children have to see it, that a parent can tell their child, is that those same white people, the same stuff that you're watching here, is exactly what they're doing today in a more refined fashion. And like you say all the time, you can use all of the different news clips of young people being terrorized and brutalized by white people in some form or fashion to bring that home in a way in which your child can be transformed by the understanding of racism, white supremacy. So, yes, I do believe that program is just a resurrection of the refinement of racism, white supremacy, and the reestablishment or reconstruction of racism, white supremacy that's to come in the upcoming election year. So I think it's just something, as far as the negative, I understand that, but I think that's one positive you can get out of it, especially if the child has to watch it for school or some purpose like that. And thank you for taking my call. I'll mute my line there.
Other folks who dialed in, who have a hand up, should be with us.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. Last night's program, I had a thought in mind when I heard that Mr. Muhammad was sent to the hospital, that it was something different than the other times that he had been to the hospital. And just by listening to the language that was used, that's why I wanted to dedicate last night my comments to his possible reverse in his health. But regardless, he's with the ancestors now. Muhammad Ali, the heavyweight title of the world, is at that time, when I was a child coming up in the 60s, it was still known as probably the most single title, sports title anyway, that anyone can achieve. And at the same time, with his influences from the Nation of Islam, and as I heard you mention, they're probably not going to bring up the Honorable Elijah Muhammad unless it's for something negative. But nevertheless, with that assistance from the Nation of Islam, with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and of course Minister Malcolm, it molded this non-white victim to what we know of him today. Dr. King kind of like said it best, you know, when he mentioned about his courage, because for all of what it's worth with sports and how, well, in the people activity of entertainment alone, on how people can become very wealthy and don't really have to take the kind of risk that he took. It showed a whole lot of courage into what he did over the course of his life. I actually met him once with myself and hundreds of other kids at an occasion during a time when he was stripped of his license to fight and couldn't leave the country. He was reconciled to attempt to make other means to make money. One of the venues was a fast food restaurant called Champ Burgers, and they cordoned off the street, one of the streets down here in South Florida, and he basically came out and you know, greeted all of the kids, all of the young people. I don't like to use the word kids, but all the young people around the street corner at that particular time. He also had a home in Brownsville is what it's called, area in South Florida at the time. But he had choices where he did not have to make the one that he actually did. I believe if he did try to leave out of Nation of Islam with Malcolm X, he probably would have been assassinated also at the same time. So there was a reason why he did not go leave the Nation of Islam with Malcolm also. But yes, there's tons of audio and visual on his legacy of speaking out against the system of racism, white supremacy. There's tons of it. I'm going to see if they air any of it. I mean, it's tons of information that I've seen over the course of about 30 years that I've seen myself, so I know it's a lot for anybody to see. And I wonder if they're going to be playing it, because I know they're going to be talking about him for about the next week or two. But anyway, I'll move on and let somebody else talk. Thank you.
Other folks, other people on the line, just don't see folks who have hands up. So if you're on the line, if you have hands up, or if you have commentary you would like to share, it is the same procedure over here, *6, and I'll be able to get your hand on the line if you have commentary. Again, the interference, it caused so many disruptions that we lost a big chunk of the folks who were listening, at least on the phone line aspect. So this is not one of those programs. If you're one of the folks listening in, if you are thinking, I will just hang out and listen and then wait until an hour later and then get my hand up, this is not a program. If you have commentary, you should go up and go ahead and get your hand up now, especially if we have any folks who saw Roots or had any commentary on that. That would be grand. Any folks, if they had a thought on that, if you actually were able to see the series. I know we talked about that on Monday, but at the time, I think it was probably airing at the time that we were broadcasting this past Monday. So I'm sure folks could not multitask in any significant manner to listen to the program and watch the show. But that would be cool. If not, maybe we can do that down the road and we have the full audience back. Certainly with Muhammad Ali, I know they'll be playing and talking about him for days and weeks, probably the rest of the year, in terms of playing footage and interviews and what have you. Certainly you can just go on YouTube and have a field day, because they have tons of content. His fights obviously are there. They have a lot of the interviews that he did with different white people, some of the college visits that he did. I mean, it's tons and tons of commentary, probably more than you even, you know, would want to invest in watching. But, I mean, it's as much time as you have to invest, it's there. You can just go and just be watching stuff for days. And a lot of it is him talking directly, explicitly about racism. I included some of that in the commentary. And even documentaries, there's so many of them. The When We Were Kings, which is about the fight between he and George Foreman, which has a lot of commentary where he's talking about racism as it leads up to the fight. The Thriller in Manila, which talks a lot about racism. That's the third fight between he and Joe Frazier. I mean, it's just, it's tons. It's tons and tons and tons of content. As much as you would like to, as much as you would like to watch, there was another, I'm not even sure that I've seen the whole documentary, but the there's another one, One Nation Divisible, which is about the fight between Joe Frazier and Muhammad Ali. I think it looks at all three of their fights and how racism impacted the way that people thought about, talked about those contests. But certainly it will be lots to check out, review as we roll. Not seeing him, I guess folks are just doing their thing, spectating, as it were, for the broadcast. The folks that had their lineup, do you all have any other comments you want to make sure you got in?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. We can hear both of you.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to say I sent you an article not too long ago, and in the article it talks about people in India who were unwittingly had their kidneys stolen for traffickers in a New Delhi hospital, and I titled it Medical Apartheid in India, and the article is referring to how I guess it's like Indian gangsters or whatever have infiltrated this hospital, and some of the assistants in the hospital have been unwittingly removing kidneys and selling them on the black market. And I thought about it, and I was like, wow, because even though the context is gang-related, the medical establishment in the U.S. operate like gangsters as well. And we don't actually talk about it in those terms, but you're absolutely right when you say the understanding of what a gangster is always a black person or a non-white person, when the what they are pales in comparison to the real gangsters who get away with it with impunity. And I just wanted to chime in with that. I just sent it to you not too long ago, so I doubt you got to look at it yet. Thank you.
Yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead, sir.
Yes, I just wanted to discuss the advent of Muhammad Ali. Had this Parkinson's issue for at least 30 years or more, and what is significant about it that I believe, and part of this information is from a documentary that was made, I think it's called Muhammad Ali and Larry Holmes. It's someone filmed Muhammad in his camp and Larry Holmes in his camp preceding the fight between the two. From a common sense factor, Muhammad Ali had no business attempting to fight Larry Holmes because, according to this documentary, he had already started having some issues dealing with his health as far as Parkinson's is concerned, the early stages of it. And that wasn't even his last fight. And so, therefore, one would expect after you retire from a sport or a job over anything, a sport, especially, you know, being, you know, most sports people are known as being healthy people, that you have a period of time where you quote unquote retired, and you, if you're active, you still engage in with his type of personality. And we all can see on film,
it never was really like that, because he had this Parkinson's even as his boxing career was coming to a close. So therefore, I would say if you were born in something like the 70s or the 80s, you didn't get a chance to hear him in that capacity that you were watching on film live. You didn't get a chance to hear it, because by that time his voice was already slurring and the physical aspects of it was. So I think that's significant from a standpoint of not seeing the live person, but have to see film from that is primarily controlled by the races, I would assume, as far as that concerned. Unless you go on YouTube, then you probably get a better chance to look. But it's always good to hear and see the person live. That sort of thing is what I'm saying. But yeah, okay, thank you.
As for the Parkinson's, you know, I used to work with a lady, and she told me that she believed that they gave him something to give him Parkinson's, you know. And I wouldn't be surprised if they don't just mysteriously come out with a cure now that he's dead. I also, as for what Waz was saying, CNN did a report 2 years ago on stealing organs in Nepal, a very near, obscure part of the world. And I think that it was, man, if I'm not mistaken, it was like 1 out of 3 people have had their kidneys stolen. I mean, it's serious here. And you could probably find that on the internet. And lastly, I watched the Roots, and it was it wasn't what I expected. You know, I have a problem with slave movies where you even have a moment of happiness for the slaves, because I just can't see them being happy at all. And I just felt like there was a lot of historical inaccuracies inside of it. Starting with the Islam aspect of everything, because it didn't exist yet. If you get Walter Williams' book, Historical Origins of Islam, it's a very modern religion, 19th and 20th century religion. Definitely wasn't around in the 1700s. The religion of Mohammedanism was, but it didn't have those ritualistic ways of praying and things like he was doing, and there was no Allah Akbar yet. There's no Quran yet. So, that was very historically inaccurate. And my number one problem with that movie, or the show, which it was a great story, you know, very inspiring, I guess, but they made white women seem like they are very friendly, like they're the friends of the blacks. They did not portray them in their proper way. White women getting hung for a slave Negro and stuff like, nah, I don't see it. We all know that their role is probably worse than the males, and it was probably just as bad. Well, I think we know that it was just as bad then. And for them to portray almost every white woman in that whole miniseries as either neutral or a friend of the blacks, to me, is just horrific. And they really messed up on that part. And I'll mute my mom.
The caller is 6492. 6492, did you have commentary you wanted to get in? And again, for folks, if you are on the temporary line that we're using for today, then just press star 6 and we can add you to the line. But caller is 6492.
Yes. Hello, everyone. I did have some commentary about Muhammad Ali and a little bit about the movie. I guess I'll go there first. I saw bits and pieces of it, and I don't think it was as, you know, interesting or as good as the original. However, I did take some time to kind of challenge some of the things that they were, presenting. Like for example, toward the end when, Chicken George, his father, his biological father sold him. And so I was live tweeting it, so I made a lot of comments about that. Now, what kind of a man is this that would just sell their own child? I said, clearly they don't think of us as humans. And typically when I tweet stuff like that, I get a lot of blowback from all the racists, but I didn't get hardly anything. They started spamming with porn instead. And then the other thing that I thought was, I think the comments about the women, they were, the white women, they were pretty much useless. They kind of stood back and watched everything happen. They had another scene that I thought was significant, and that was where the two white males were, they got into some sort of argument at a dinner party, and they decided to handle it civilly by having a duel. And they drew straws and took turns shooting each other. It's the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. And I said, now this is what you call civilized, right? You sit there and you shoot each other. They kept going until one of them gave up. And I said, well, this would be a good way to handle all these wars, just let two white men shoot at each other until one die, they either die or they give up. And then as far as Muhammad Ali, they've already started rewriting history. There was, I don't remember his name, but one of the sports commentators, a white male, made the comment that he was beyond race and religion and everyone could just really like him, and which is ridiculous. He fought from the day he became a Muslim, and before that he fought racism. And he never was anything other than a black man and proud of it. They always do that, just rewrite history. So I said, probably 100 years from now, the greatest boxer of all time, they'll suddenly transform and they'll forget that he's black at all, and change the story to him being the greatest boxer, all right, but he happened to be a white man, like they've done with all other aspects of our history. And I did get a chance to see him. My dad took the whole family to a lecture he was giving up in Flint, Michigan. I'm not sure. I was pretty young at the time. I'm not sure if this was before or after he lost the title. But, he was stripped of the title, rather. But it was just amazing. He was a brilliant man, just very poised, full of life, full of... overly serious, as you can see in a lot of these, he'll joke around, but he never allowed them to openly or in his space, talk down to him or be rude to him or mistreat him. And I think that's why they hated him so. And back then it was very clear they hated him. It's amazing to hear them singing his praises now. It's almost
somebody still on the line?
I'm here. I'm Joy. Are you still with us? Not hearing you. Looks like she might have got disconnected. I think we might have lost Joy. I will get her line back. If she dials back in, we'll go back to her so we can get the rest of her commentary
The caller at 3637, 3637, did you have commentary you wanted to add?
Yes, I did. Thank you for taking my call, and hello, everyone on the line. Mr. Muhammad Ali, I just believe that they did do something like that to him because he had such a loud voice, and he talked loud to racism, white supremacy, and he talked loud and spoke down to racism, white supremacy. And at the end, he barely had a voice. He went totally quiet due to the Parkinson's disease. So, I mean, I understand he was in boxing and everything, and you can get hurt in your head and everything, but I don't trust it, you all. I just don't trust it. And I wanted to say something about Roots. Now, I'm not watching it, but my family members are. And when I go downstairs, I might get something to drink or something. I'll glance to see what's going on. And so I seen some of that duel, and that reminded me of the Ben Tillman book that we read. I said, yep, there it is. I said, that's in history books. You all should read that book. So I suggested that book to some family members, and hopefully they'll get that. And I also seen a scene where I think there was a young white person that's friends with another young black person, and I think that's the character Kizzy, from what I remember. But when I walked in, they had got a gross anatomy book, and they were looking through it, and they got through the sexual organs and everything, and the white girl wanted to see if Kizzy has some pubic hairs. I said, yep, there it is, sexual deviance in white people and young white people. So that's really all I see in the Roots. I wasn't really watching it. Like I said, I was walking by and catching scenes here and there. And I say to Muhammad Ali, and that's all I would like to say tonight. Thank you so much.
For sure, for sure. Appreciate that. I think we should have Joy back with us as well. I think she got disconnected, but she should be back with us now.
Hello, sorry about that. The call dropped and on my cell phone, and it appears to be, having signal problems. But anyway, I think I had said everything that I wanted to say. I just, and this has been a rough year as far as, celebrities, black celebrities, passing away. And especially, people that can teach us about, the system of white supremacy. But at least there is video and recordings of them, to help us learn. And Muhammad Ali, he'll always be the greatest. And I thank you for taking my call.
For sure, for sure. I guess out of the folks that are here, one, I wanted to make sure that I noted the incident that happened with the 19-year-old white terrorist in Indiana who started shooting people. He shot, killed three people. He's charged with killing three people. And he said he was inspired by the film franchise The Purge, which we've mentioned on this program before. I thought that was hugely significant because we've talked about that film, and I have said that I think the purpose is to foment this sort of just more intense, flagrant white violence and terrorism targeting black people. And he said specifically, now they didn't say it in the audio clip that I played, but it was in the Washington Post that it was reported that he was not just interested in killing people and violence, particularly he wanted to exercise violence against black people. And it said in the report that one of the people that he shot, he called them a nigger after he shot and killed the person and just went out and did all that. I'm not surprised at all. I think that's what I've been saying. When I saw that film, that's what the whole thing is about. That's what the first installment is about. They go to kill a black person. It's a mob of white people who go to kill an unarmed black person, and that they spend the whole movie trying to hunt down and kill this one black person. And then the second film, They're going and they're trying to rape and kill two black people. It's a black female. Now, there are other white people as well, but these are the first two characters I think that you see and are kind of following along the movie. It's two black females, and it's stated explicitly that they're trying to rape them and then just kill them along with everybody else. And they have a new installment that's supposed to be coming out sometime this summer. I think it's called Purge Election Year, no less, in alignment with Donald Trump. So I thought that was hugely important. And the only reason that I found that article was just doing my N-word search to see what pops up. I said, you can just find what's happening with the news. Just search the word nigger. And I put in N-word search and boop, that popped up right in the Washington Post. But with Roots, an investor had asked, why not do a counter-racist analysis of Roots? We've done other films and TV show, The Purge, Walking Dead. We've done a lot of other films and movies in the past, 12 Years a Slave. Why not do a counter-racist analysis of Roots? You know, couldn't it be used as a tool to teach racism, white supremacy to younger people, probably black people in general, but in particular younger people? Multiple people said that. Do you all think that is valid, I guess, and from the folks who saw it, did it seem like content that you would say, yeah, you know, if I have children or if I just have, you know, black people, period, even though they're not children, that, yeah, we could get this and we could sit down and we could dissect this and pick out racism, I guess, particularly for the people who have seen it. What would your response to that be?
I would say absolutely. I think the points that Thomas brought out, just with the timing and them claiming that the people of Jaffere were actually Muslim in the sense that people are familiar with. I think that those are things that I think would be very, very constructive as far as correcting that stuff. And then the scene that the woman, the sister that I was speaking just brought up in regards to the little girl and the sexual deviancy, I thought that was really good as well, because it was something that I was thinking about before she actually brought it up. And I thought it was very poignant because they actually centered it around a young white female and her sexual deviancy. And then it's funny because later on in the film, she actually betrays Kizzy. And her and Kizzy supposedly developed this really close relationship. And then she literally turns on her like white people always do. So I think there's a lot of constructive things we can get to help, you know, young people, like you said, and adults themselves, as well as just correcting the inaccuracies of the film and calling out the racism, white supremacy, in just the general practice of how the film was made. So definitely, I think it would be constructive.
I also think that it can be very constructive to do that. I saw the original one back in 1977. I was in college at the time, and saw bits and pieces of the recent version, and it basically has all of the parts that's in the 1977 version, but it adds on a few pieces here and there, primarily whoever is the I looked up just about all of the people who were responsible for the 2016 version, and all of them, from my understanding, are white people except for one person, a black male. I believe he went to Florida A&M. I just can't think of his name, but someone said it. I would be able to recognize it. Just it's in my head somewhere. But it appears in the 2016 version that someone just sat around and thought of ways to make the white characters in the story acceptable to the point to whereas they had some sort of sympathy for the non-white black people in some kind of way, or was not as vicious as in reality we know white people are in the past as well as in the present. So there's all kinds of things that one can do. And I have been kind of like editorying the program itself from my son. He's interested. He's 20 years old. He's interested in looking at it. And after it's over with, I began to tell him on how it contrasts with the 1977 version and how it appears that someone actually is kind of like twisting the reality of race of the white supremacy back during that time around to make it acceptable in a sense, you know, by kind of like making the white characters especially a lot more acceptable in the situation, whereas just the whole issue of racism, white supremacy, and the practice of something called slavery is absolutely nothing constructive about it at all. But they try to make it seem like, oh, well, in some pockets, it's not all that bad, you know, that type of thing. So, yeah, so it definitely needs to be done. It'd be very constructive for it to be done. Thank you.
I don't personally think that it'll be constructive at all. I personally think that the original roots that came out in 1977 was one of the most destructive things to ever happen to black people. Goes up there with integration, cracking AIDS. They painted a narrative for us that totally disassociated us from this land in a way that we didn't have before. I'm just always look at history through the eyes of what's true and what's not, what I could prove and what I can't. And I just find it very odd that white people who lie about everything are just so gung-ho to tell us, well, y'all came from Africa, and totally disassociates us from having any claims here. And I've read several books that show that black people were here. And I'm just not totally sold on that narrative. And I think that just the movie, The Original Roots, was made to enforce that narrative in blacks. After that, you had the Black Power movement. You had a lot of the African scholars. A lot of things came after that, the kente cloths and all of that. And I think that was a strategic and deliberate move by white people to totally take us away from having any claims here. Like I said before, I never seen 10 Indians in one place. Maybe they never existed. Maybe we had them, you know? And I just don't believe anything white people say. And they can't prove it. So I'm not sure if they'll be constructive because it puts us right back in Africa. And I just don't think that's where we need to be. I think we need to be here and doing what we need to do here and trying to get some justice here as opposed to somewhere where we're never going to go. And I'll mute my line.
I would say, you have agreement with, having the movie analyzed, almost scene by scene. And that's because that is one way to stop the misunderstandings and the damage that, all the violence can do. But kind of in the beginning, I think it was a little better in that it showed us, in Africa and the beauty of our people. But over and over again, it shows the cruelty, the insane cruelty of white people. And I don't think that the average black person, even though there's all this violence, and even though all these things happen, they don't understand that this is who they are. And the sooner we understand that this is who they are, this is how they've always been and always will be back on the ship. I did see that scene, and they were just horribly cruel on the ship. And in every aspect, beating Kunta Kinte until he relents and says his name is Toby. Now, what kind of a sane person would do that? I think that right, you know,
I think your line might have dropped again. Yeah, thanks, Joyce. Line cut out again. If she dials back, we will nab her. Roots, so I cannot offer any detailed analysis of the film, the reboots that came out this week and all of that. I can only say that I'm suspicious in general of, and I wrote about this week. You can go to the blog, my post about Roots and what I think white people's assessment is as they watch this miniseries. But I'm suspicious just flat out of anything where white people are coming and saying, yes, we need to have more slavery films. We had Django, we had 12 Years a Slave, we had Book of Negroes, The Birth of a Nation is coming out in a matter of months, so I've been told, and The Good Lord Bird is supposed to be coming out in a matter of months, and there are even more slave films coming. If you look online for some of the projects that are coming down the road in the next 2, 3, 4 years, they have even more. I'm highly suspicious of them continuing to have all of these representations, mainstream films that are well budgeted. I'm very suspicious of them being so enthusiastic about putting these projects out and then giving awards and Emmys and Oscars and all that for them. With a line of thought that this is to help inform black people, right? Or at minimum, we can use these as tools to inform black people about slavery or racism in general. The only thing I can say is I feel the same way that I do about the cell body cams, dash videos and body cams that they've been saying about police. There are an exorbitant number of slave films, not just the ones that I just mentioned. That's like stuff that's come out in the last 2, 3 years. That's not even all of the films, slave films that have come out in the last 2, 3 years. There are just tons of them. I'd say one thing I feel confident, we do not need any more slave flicks. There are tons of them. Anybody that needs a slave flick got that covered. Tons of them, subtitled, you can get French ones, all different types, all over the world. You can go through and take all the notes you need. We do not need any more new ones. I'm of the opinion that just continuing to show these images of savagery and brutality against black people, white people just enjoy that, period. And I think you have a lot of white people, they enjoy that and are looking for an opportunity to hearken back, to experience that again, where we can be that flagrant and intense in the way that we go about practicing white terrorism. I don't even think that sort of thing is healthy. It reminded me of Pam's concept of psychological terrorism. Again, the same assessment that I have of all the cell cam, the body cam footage and dash cam footage of police mauling black people. I don't need to see every single video of a black person being mauled. I'm very aware that that's happening, and I think most black people are aware on some level that that's happening. Now, they might not have all the details and intricacies about the system of white supremacy, but most of the black people that I come in contact with, they tend to have some knowledge that, yeah, the police, they just brutalize black people on a regular. I don't need to see everyone. I think that just adds to the John Henryism and stress of racism, white supremacy, and how it impacts us. The same thing with lynchings from the 20th century, where you might not necessarily be lynched. You might not even see a lynching, but continuing to have these incidents and having postcards where they're flashed here and flashed there and all of that, that in and of itself is a form of violence against you, that this could be you, that this could happen to you, just reinforcing white power and black helplessness. I think that is a huge aspect of all of this. Yes, in my opinion, yes, you could go through and reconstruct and what the white woman's doing, blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, you could do that with any – that's the thing that I said just about movies in general. You could do that. You could pick films at random and do that. The racism is going to be there. I said that for years. The racism is going to be there. You could do that with Purge. You could do that with X-Men. It doesn't even have to be a slavery film. You could do that with any film
depicting white people and black people and how they interact, and you can pick out a lot of those same dynamics. And just, I guess I'll end, so I don't get carried away, with regards to slavery, and I think I said this yesterday on medical apartheid, for folks who participated in the book study session, The Half Has Never Been Told, oh, man, I didn't see Roots. I saw the original, but I didn't see the new one. I know they did not include a scene where a white person shoves a hot poker down a black person's throat. That was in The Half Has Never Been Told as a form of punishment. I know that was not in the new Roots. I know they did not include a scene of a white person raping a 10 or 11-year-old child in the new Roots. Not just, let me know. I mean, like, the total rape of a child, male, female, whatever the case may be, or raping them publicly in front of a whole lot of people. I know that that was not included in the new Roots. And I mean, as whatever savageness that they include, they're not even getting, as the book is appropriately titled, The Half Has Never Been Told. That's not even getting you close to the barbarity that was heaped upon black people. When you ask to go sit down and study the genuine record of what they did, it is. I don't even think you would be able to sit through a movie that authentically depicted what they did to us. That's kind of the other, my concluding thought that I would get about all of that. There are tons of books, and I know you have a lot more people that would be willing to go and watch a film or a TV show or whatever the case may be, and that can be great for a starting point. But when you begin to get a more accurate assessment of what has been done to us, and then you go and you look at, you know, whatever they have presented, Django or whatever else that's supposed to be an authentic representation of the history of enslavement of black people. For me, it is just that is another act of racism, white supremacy, to have some racist come and finance and put this project together and say, I wanted to do my part and tell the true story of what we've done to the Negroes in this area of the world. And I will hush there. Let me make sure we didn't miss anybody who dialed in with a hand up. I do see other people who dialed in, but it doesn't look like they have a hand up at the moment. Again, you need to press *6 if you have commentary you would like to share. Did folks, if I've been talking crazy, you can feel free to let me know if anything I said didn't make sense, and or if anyone who read my assessment from Roots, and if it was talking crazy or didn't make sense, you can feel free to set me straight there as well.
No, I think you make perfect sense. And just to let you know, there's actually another. I was thinking about you because I saw them play a commercial during Roots with another slave movie, where it looks like it's about the blacks who were in the Union in the Union War. And then there's another one with Denzel. It's more like a cowboy, but it's around slavery time. They're calling him nigger and stuff. So I think that you're right. They're trying to bring back a new reconstruction of white supremacy, and that's why we're getting all these movies. It's going to put us in a new postbellum or a new antebellum type of situation.
I saw that. I wasn't even watching Roots. I saw that just the TV was on, and I looked, and it was a black person. And I think I was even writing the Roots piece, and I was like, now see, that's exactly what I'm talking about. And I just turned and looked. I was stunned. Like, I was almost ready to start bothering people. Like, do you see this? They've got another. They've got. I think it's called the Free State of Jones or something. But it's set, I think, during the Civil War, and this is supposed to be a territory, I think, in Mississippi, where they this little portion they didn't want to go with the Confederacy, although there looks like they're still apparently slaves, black people, yes, that are in shackles and what have you there. I was just like, see, this is exactly what I'm talking about. We need to break down every one of these, or we need to now have 50 brand new slave flicks. I'm cool. I don't need to see any of these. I don't care if a black person did it, a white person did it, Nate Parker's. I'm way less excited about The Birth of a Nation. I'm cool. You can keep all of these. Let's just try to solve the problem as opposed to making 8 billion films about how we have been shackled and skinned alive and raped and everything else. Let's just solve the problem.
Did you get my email about Nate Parker, Gus?
Yes. Cowbell.
Yep, cowbell, and went to court for raping a white woman in college. Was acquitted, but his accomplice, well, the person that he was, the white woman accused him, the other person did go to jail for that crime. and ended up still marrying a white woman from the college. Just I just said very odd, very strange.
It reminded me of the Little Rock Nine.
Yeah, I don't think there's any horror movie that they got out today that can even compare to what I read in The Half Has Never Been Told.
American Slave Coast, that's another one. I was even going to include that when people, because I saw many of the articles that I saw this week where people were saying that this is a great tool because people are ignorant about slavery. Same thing that they say about racism in general. People are ignorant, white people, black, everybody's ignorant, so we need to make more of these films. I have seen where whites have written a lot of books where they flex great expertise about this subject matter. American Slave Coast is another one I would recommend, and that too. I have seen nothing that compares to the savagery that is documented there, and in particular the widespread sexual abuse of black people, required, mandatory sexual abuse of black people that went on for centuries. Continues to this day, Daniel Holtzclaw and others. But I just don't know who would want to sit down and watch all of this, horror. That does not sound cool to me. And even the counter-racist analysis aspect of it, I think you can do that, as I said, with any films. It's so much material that's already here that you can do that. I just don't. Me personally, if folks have found that that's constructive, if you have children and they're interested, right on. Anything that folks are excited about, enthused about, interested in, and you can use that as a means to get them to get a better understanding of racism, do it. But Gus T., you have to count me out. That we did 12 Years a Slave, the book and the film. We did Django. I've had my fill of breaking down slave flicks.
What I get out of all of these movies is the racist is indirectly or directly instructing us to survive through all of these different episodes of abuse, terror, and keep taking it. That's the only "quote unquote" moral of the story that's I see involved at the whole concept of these different programs and movies. That's the only thing that can come out of it, because there is no real deep or thorough discussion on any of these projects that come on TV or at the movies. Other than that. And too many of us as non-white black people especially have accepted surviving as living. And because I hear it in our dialogue a lot. And some of us actually mistake it for a strength of having to suffer through mistreatment and terror, that somehow it makes you strong, and that escapes logic with me, that whole idea. But that's what I get out of those movies and programs.
I agree, and I personally, I have never felt strong. I have seen Goodbye, Uncle Tom. I've seen Amistad. I've seen 12 Years a Slave. I've seen Sankofa. It's a long list of slave flicks. Whitey, Whity, if you want to see a foreign film made by a German, it's subtitled, but it's still a plantation flick about slavery in this part of the world. I have seen lots of them, and I never felt stronger after having
watched them. In fact, I think when I watched Goodbye, Uncle Tom, which is another foreign one, when I watched it, there was, I think, five of us black people watching it, and I think half the room was sobbing and incoherent by the time we got midway through it. So I don't think anybody that I've seen any of these films with felt stronger or better about themselves after seeing any of this. So, anywho, any other commentary folks wanted to make sure they got in? If you missed anybody's hand, you should press star six. If you have a comment you want to make sure you get in, Roots related or no, know a lot of things went on this week. Oh, the whoops. Let's see. The caller at the last three digits. I think this is our caller in Ohio. Did you have commentary?
Yes. Hello to you, Gus, and to all the callers on this evening. And just to say that I'm glad you're back up, because I just, like, when you went down, I was like, oh my gosh. So I'm glad that you know, back on, and hope they get that situated. But just a couple of things that I want to say. It's a good show tonight. You know, a lot of condolences and to the family of Muhammad Ali on his transitioning. And just one of the things that I wanted to say about Muhammad Ali is, you know, need to say today a lot of people's posting things. And I had a couple of friends that had posted some photos of him. One, a friend of mine, was just like a sister, and she had a picture of her mother with Muhammad Ali, because her mother had worked at our children's hospital here in the Akron area. And I was just like, wow. And then I had another friend that had a picture of her grandfather and uncle, Muhammad Ali. And I was just telling myself, one of the things that I loved about him was that he had time for regular people. You know, you can see a lot of, you know, photos with celebrities or other quote-unquote known people, but there are a lot of photos of him with unknown people, you know, like the everyday folk. And I just think that speaks volumes, because, you know, today, you know, you see a lot of celebrities. Maybe there are more pictures of them with everyday folk, but it just seems like they've seen a lot of pictures of them with themselves. So I just wanted to bring that out. And I don't even have to go into the unapologetically black, strong black man that he was. I mean, that speaks for itself. In terms of Roots, now I will be honest with you. I didn't see this one, and I was old enough when the original one came out. I was in college, and of course I did not get to watch that one because it was the first series, and so, like, it started on Sunday, and at the time I was working, and so in the evening I worked 3 to 11, and so you know how you miss a day or you miss some days, and I'm just like, oh, I don't want to sit up here. Because, you know, back then, you didn't have, like, today, you know, you could turn on a channel. I think, like, even today on Centric or some channel, TV One or something, they were showing the whole thing, you know, so you didn't have that back in 77. So I just didn't want to watch. I didn't want nobody to tell me about it. But I did see different scenes, you know. I turn on the TV a little bit, and I see a little something, and I go on. But now, you know, as far as what people want you to do, I don't necessarily think that it will. But last night, when I listened to a little bit of, caught the end of the book review that we're doing, you know, you're doing medical practice, you spoke about, and you just said it too, about the people you really want the true story, or at least close to the true story of what has happened to black people in this country, then we need to be reading books like Medical Apartheid. We need to be reading books like The Half That's Never Told. We need to be reading books like Slavery by Another Name, Any Other Name. I listened to one of your shows in the archives yesterday at work, the Sublets, where they wrote the book about breeding, you know. And these are, if we are seriously true about wanting to know our history in terms of white people. I mean, we know what that is. I think it was Wednesday morning I was driving to work, and Tom Joyner on his show, he made a statement, because I need to say, you know, Snoop Dogg made his statement about, you know, my fans, I'm actually out of boycott. And, you know, they went in on him, you know, Roland Martin, Tom Joyner, you know, so people went in on him. I saw some things written on Facebook, you know, and they were upset about him saying that. And Tom Joyner made a statement that he says, I would watch slave movie after slave movie after slave movie until white people say they're tired of slave movies. And I remember I was driving down the road, and I'm just like, that's not going to ever happen, because they are the dominant ones. And they, and this made me think of the homoerotic experiences that they have watching these type of movies, and they can keep them coming. You know, I mean, let's face it, they can keep them coming. And as that image is burned in their mind that we're dominant, we're mighty, we're superior than these people, the image that's burned in our mind is that what? We're weak, we're inferior, so on and so forth and so on and so forth. So I just don't think, in my opinion, that it's worth it. But, you know, and I will say I did not see the new one or what it was called, Roots Reimagined. I did not see it, and it's not like it's anything I want to watch. So, you know, I just wanted to, you know, add that because I just think that if black people really are serious about, you know, learning our true story, and I'm going to even say this, I'm not even talking about Africa. I'm talking about our true story in this, what is called this area of the world. And I really don't think that we are because, I'm going to say this now, I'll mute myself. It is sad that we as a people don't have any problem watching movies made by the descendants of the people who treated us horribly. And we don't have any problem when, you know, watching these movies that they reimagined and literally are saying to us, well, this is how it went. And I think that's really kind of sad, you know, for us as a people. So, you know, thank you, and I'll mute myself.
With that one y'all was talking about, I think it's Matthew McConaughey playing in that one. And, you know, really, who wants to see it? I mean, that's the white savior. They're giving us that. In that movie, and it's just, I'm done with them. I mean, how many do we really need? They have put Mandingo up there on Netflix. I tried to watch it. I was 15 minutes into it. I just couldn't do it. It's horrible. I just can't sit there and watch that. That's why I'm not watching Roots. My family is. Like I said, I go downstairs. I might glance at it. It's something, and it's like a, yeah.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
One thing that I think this really is that, you know, kind of to boil all this down is that this is really propaganda. And, you know, for us, it's dangerous propaganda for all the reasons everyone articulated. But what we really need is, and that's the power of, like, the book studies, is that, you know, we have a chance to, you know, analyze what we're seeing. And with the way these movies are coming out, it's not happening. And it's hitting the mass of black people. Unfortunately, they're not reading. They're not listening to the book club. And so what I'm thinking is that there we need a way to counter the propaganda that's being spewed throughout the country, actually throughout the world, through these movies. And I can't think of a good way to do this other than, I don't know if blogging helps, do they read, if we could, you know, like, I don't know, but I think it's, I really think it's dangerous propaganda in that, and it's been said very well, but that it makes us look weak, it makes us tolerant of being abused, and it doesn't point out the abusers. It doesn't put, you know, a finger in their face. You're doing something that's wrong. It is horrible. It is hideous. And it's not going in our minds that way either when you're watching these kind of movies. And so but I don't know what can be done about it if we don't challenge these ideas that are coming out of these movies, if we just, you know, put it on ignore. And I will mute my line.
Great point. I think that I definitely would encourage, I think that's the importance of not being spectators, like folks being active, active not in the sense of you need to watch the film, but in terms of whatever access that you have, whether it's if you do videos, if you have a vlog, a YouTube channel, if you blog, if you write, whatever it is, and then
Even people I know, it was talked about, I think last week, folks were talking about doing independent projects where we can be coming up with our own content so we don't have to, you know, just wait around and hope that they have the latest installment of Roots or whatever else they decide to reboot, Queen or anything else, where we can be making our own content that is something that's going to be helpful to us and not just continue images of black people in shackles and being brutalized. I think that would be helpful, particularly getting things that are helping us to solve problems, to not just black people being abused. I don't really see very much difference between Roots and something like Fruitvale Station. Black people being abused. We already know how this is going to end. Black person dead. I mean, they love showing content like that. Love it, love it, love it, love it, love it. Black death, black people die. Well, let's make the Trayvon Martin movie. Let's make the Oscar Grant movie. Let's make the Jordan Davis movie. And they'll probably just keep them coming. Let's make the Renisha Bride movie. Let's make the, Miriam Carey movie. Anything. Just black people suffering, black people dying, black misery. They love that sort of thing. I think we can make a change. And as everyone, I think, has stated with the propaganda and the impact, moving to, well, what should we be doing to solve this problem? What sort of information is going to help us stop black people from being brutalized, killed, harmed? In my view, they don't ever get to that sort of thing. It just stays stuck on black people brutalized, black people dying. That's, I think, what we should be pushing in. All of us, the people that are listening right now, doing as much as we can to really start producing some of that content, asking some of that content, questioning where is that content, as opposed to just having it rammed down our throats. Slave Negroes, and you're good for being beaten, and O.J. Simpson coming down the pike next week. That's what I mean. Like, that's all we got. We go from Roots, 8-hour documentary on Roots and Negro slavery, to 8-hour documentary on O.J. Simpson. Like, that's what we can look forward to as long as the system of white supremacy in place. And that's another one that's not really giving us any solutions moving towards what things that we can, should be doing to help solve this problem. Just another one that kind of, this is why you niggers would be better off in shackles, as Cliven Bundy said, just to have a Runtle James running around and raping, killing, terrorizing white women. We just should have had you all locked up, and we wouldn't have had to deal with this in the first place. OJ was in the first Roots, if my memory is correct. Anything folks want to get in before we get ready to wrap things up?
Yes, I wanted to say, I think you're absolutely right. Like, when you look at it in context, they're never going to give you anything with a solution in it, because this is supposed to be our state in perpetuity, that we're supposed to be abused, terrorized, and killed for eternity by white people, and they're supposed to get away with it. So we're never going to see anything like that unless, like you said, we start making the content ourselves. Outside of that, everything and anything I look at, it's always in the context of white supremacy. And my sole purpose for watching it was just that if I came across young children that might have had to see it for school, I at least know what they saw. And that way we could have some kind of discussion around it that can be constructive as far as their understanding of racism, white supremacy. And most importantly, the fact that those people being portrayed in those films are the same people that if it's a white teacher they have that told them as an assignment to watch that show, she's just like the people they're watching on camera. If you can instill that in your children, and like I said, even show them all the modern terrorism of young black children so they understand that they're not safe, then I think it can be constructive in that sense. But yes, I totally agree with you. They're never going to put out the solution. Thank you.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. This is the last thing after what the young man just said before me. And let us be honest, too. We would be foolish to think that they will put out the true story or close to the true story. You know, that's just not going to happen. They, you know, first thing, well, it should be common sense that you would tell the story from your point of view.
You know, that I just think that's common sense. And I just say that, too, because I know sometimes, you know, black people, and I don't want to get into anti-blackness because, I mean, I remember, and I'll just say this real quick, looking at Dr. Wilson, the lecture, it was on YouTube, and like she was saying, she would just give them A pluses because the thing about it is they have just done a number on us, you know, whereas we don't know whether we're coming or going left from right, up from down, in from out. And even like somebody said tonight on your show that just recently that we thinking that, you know, we're surviving and thinking that we're living and we're barely surviving, you know. So I just think that, there's somewhere in that, too, that we've got to be able to relate to black people. You can't depend on these people to tell a story. It will always be told from their point of view. And then the other thing I want to say, like the young lady said about reaching out and trying to get people somehow to look at these things, because the truth be told, too, even listening to the book stories, just, I go to work and I listen to like the medical part time, because one thing, I'm sitting at my desk, I work a job and I can have earplugs in. And it's not like I can always turn it off, but when I sit down, the point is to listen to the program. And because I'm working, I can't get up, you know, from my desk and just leave it. And it kind of like forced me to listen to it because these things are hard to listen to. It's hard to listen to just the horrendous things that's done to, you know, to human beings. And these are my people. These are the people I come from. And they're just hard to listen to, but somehow we're going to have to break that to be able to listen to it and to learn our story and to learn who we are. And I'm a firm believer when we begin to learn who we are, we will learn who they are. But I truly believe when we begin to learn who we are, we will begin to change. Once we begin to change, they will have to change. Anyway, that's it. Thank you, and I'll mute myself.
Mm-hmm. Anything else folks want to make sure they get in before we wrap things up? Some folks are satisfied. Assume folks are satisfied. Certainly would echo. It's always good. I think I've said that before. It's always good to have a reference point if younger people are interested. Although I did have a even question about that, just based on the timing of when this series aired, it was competing directly with the NBA playoffs two nights that it was on. Certainly, you don't have to watch. You didn't have to watch it at that moment. I think folks have already said that it's being rebroadcast, and folks got all kinds of great technology and what have you, so you can watch it whenever you feel like it. But it's always great to have a reference point with what younger folks or even just black people in general, what they're watching, what they're paying attention to. They certainly got a lot of attention, not just this week. They've been talking about it in the buildup to it for a long time, I think years ago when they were first coming up with the idea that they were going to reboot the series. So I think that always I see the constructive value in being informed about newer projects, newer things that black people are talking about that will help you be able to explain, articulate, reference racism, white supremacy, and move towards problem solving. But absolutely, the end goal, us reforming our behavior, that is what we're trying to do, behavior modification of black people. That is what is going to solve this problem. I do not expect whites to discontinue the practice of racism, white supremacy. They will camouflage, they will conceal, they will alter, but the general commitment to white terrorism, that is not going anywhere. That's just what it's going to be now forever. And if we don't solve this problem, they'll just be making, you know, Roots version 15 by the time that we get to the year 2500. With that, we will be back. The programs for the week, I will post them. Hopefully, I will have to check. I actually dialed us in on both lines on the free HD line. It seems that it is working now because some folks were still there. I guess they didn't get the note that I posted on Facebook and what have you for the temporary number that we were using because we had so many tech issues. But it
seems to be working now. It's been working without any problems for about the last 40 minutes or so. So hopefully when we're on this week, it will be back to the normal line, the normal call-in number and everything, so we won't have all these nutty problems. But definitely, again, thanks to all the folks who were patient and dialed in on the other lines so that we could, you know, participate and maintain the broadcast. Some of the content that we addressed today will have an opportunity. People can bring that up either next week or some of the next programs that we have during the week. People can address issues that we didn't get to talk about today with the full COWS audience. But the archives will be correct. Folks will be able to access everything, the news clips and the commentary from the folks who hung in, participated. Thanks again for being patient. But just check the you can check the COWS Facebook page. And I guess make sure if you do listen to the COWS, make sure you check, like, join the Facebook group and Facebook pages. We have two for the COWS. If you go to facebook.com/RWSWJ, that is the Facebook page. You'll see posts. You'll see the post for this program and what have you. And I generally post information. If anything like what happens today, we have major technical problems. If I have to use the backup line or anything, I'll post all that updated information right there. So you can just feel free to go there. You can also drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. If something happens, I try to send out emails. I did send out emails to all the folks who wrote me with the updated information so that they could chime in and know what was happening with the broadcast. But untiljustice@gmail.com, that is the email. And then the Facebook pages, I put the information on Twitter as well, @UntilJustice. So make sure to use all of those resources. I post there anyway when we're not having any tech issues, just so that you know the broadcast time and who the guest is going to be and all that stuff, as well as the normal phone number and the address so that you can listen at Black Talk Radio Network. But feel free, you can post or comment, contact me through any of those venues, social media sites, or my email. If there's a problem like this, to get the update to figure out what's happening. Anywho, check the pages, and we'll have our guests' program times for this week. You already know up front, we'll be here Thursday. This is our second time around for Workplace Racism. We had outstanding participation. We did the Thursday program for Workplace Racism just a few days ago. I hope that will continue. 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, exclusive Workplace Racism for our Thursday broadcast, and then Medical Apartheid on Friday. Outstanding book. I'm so happy that we listeners, you all chose that, and that, you know, even though it did take us some time to get to that book, it was worth the wait. It has been an outstanding and even that, because some of that does deal with plantation slavery. I don't think that was in the New Roots series, where you had white people experimenting on black people and using materials that you use on shoemaking to crack open babies' skulls. That was in Medical Apartheid. I think they left that out of Roots, both versions. I could be wrong, but I didn't hear anybody talk about that. But Medical Apartheid Session 8. This coming Friday, we're in Chapter 9, the willful, deliberate exposal of black people to all sorts of radiation. That's what that chapter is about, as we are beyond the halfway point in Harriet Washington's phenomenal book. And for the folks who were asking, I did post our 2009 broadcast with Dorothy Roberts, because I've mentioned her a lot. As we've been talking about Medical Apartheid, her book, Killing the Black Body. She did three visits to the COWS. This is her first visit, Killing the Black Body, which is an amazing book, in my top 10. It's just phenomenal. I posted it on our Facebook page. I posted it on our Twitter page as well. You can listen to it online or download it. Even Dorothy Roberts, she hit us on Facebook. I tagged her in it, and she shared as well. So right on to Dorothy Roberts, one of our favorites, all three times that she's been on the program, and all three times she had outstanding information. If you have any problems, gripes, guest suggestions, complaints, again, the email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Certainly, you can contact us on Facebook or wherever else, but if it's a guest suggestion, it would be best if it's at my email, untiljustice@gmail.com, because I have folders and things to make sure I don't lose if it's something that is specifically about a guest suggestion. That way, if it takes me some time and I have to come back and look at it, I won't lose it. I'll be able to find it quickly, efficiently, and get on it. Sometimes it takes us a few weeks or even a few months to get to guest suggestions.
With that, again, thanks for folks tuning in, and we'll have more commentary on Muhammad Ali as we go. We have a ways to go before we complete medical apartheid, but I was thinking Blood Brothers might be a great book for us to read next, again, about the friendship between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X. Wouldn't be until next month anyway, but just might something folks can think on. I was hoping we could do some fiction, because I like to read at least one bit of fiction in the summertime, because it's a little bit easier to read, and just to read something that's a little fun and enjoyable, still about racism, but not as intense and just devastating as what we've been reading with medical apartheid. But given the circumstances, it might be appropriate time to revisit Minister Malcolm Muhammad Ali's relationship, and even take some lessons for what racism, white supremacy does to frequently keep us in contact, and how we can minimize that. But that's something to think about as we roll. We will wrap there. I know it was a lovely day here in Washington State, starting to feel like summertime finally. That does not mean cut a fool. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. If you're going to be out and about, partying, whatever the case may be, I would encourage you get to one spot and stay there. You do not want to be under the influence behind the wheel. Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, they are looking for you if you have melanin to ruin your life, if not to out and out take your life. You do not want to make their job easy by being under the influence. And I can even say specifically for Washington State, and I think this would apply for Oregon and all the other places where they've legalized cannabis, even having cannabis in the vehicle in a state where it's legal, that is still against the law. It's just a variety of things where you could just end up having all kinds of just really, really easily avoidable problems if we could just stick to being sober. We don't want any of white folks' poisons, chemicals, toxins. Keep all that stuff. We don't need any of it. Let's just get this problem solved. And then, you know, we can think about any intoxicants after we have a system of justice. If you're going to be in a vehicle, buckle up. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.